Stephen Cluxton is on the pitch. He is togged out for Dublin.
Are you sure he's not a mascot, Joe?
I am 100% sure he's not a mascot. Stephen Cluxton is part of the Dublin panel today.
I'm surprised as anyone, Joe.
Subscribe to the OTB GAA podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
OTB AM with Gillette Labs. Get the ultimate shave or your money back. Neon Night Edition available now.
All right, you're very welcome along. It is finally Thursday. All week long I've been telling you folks that it's Thursday, but today is finally the day. It is Thursday. You're welcome along to OTB AM. We'd love to hear from you. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. If the phone is plugged in or charged, a little bit of controversy around the office about the phone not being charged. We're not throwing anybody under the bus here, Colm, are we? Colm's here, good morning to you.
Hi, Jer.
Shane's here. Shane, good morning to you.
Good morning, folks. How are things?
So, Arsenal beat Bayern Munich 2-0 last night. Katie McCabe, absolutely starring role as they head into the semi-finals of the Champions League. And then she gets hacked down, brutally.
Hacked down.
This isn't too close to the World Cup for us to be worried, is it?
What do we know? Doing maths. 3.5 months out to the first game, July 20th.
Nervous waiting for the scan this morning.
All about the scan today. Mm. Katie herself posted on Twitter after the match. She was obviously delighted with her performance there. She's on the screen for people who can see. She's in the protective boot on crutches.
And smiling.
She reveals, smiling, yeah. Delighted. The caption reflects that. And then she said, scan is tomorrow, i.e. today. Then tomorrow, Vera Powell names her squad for the USA back-to-back friendlies, which her own Kathleen McNamee will be at covering. And hopefully then we'll find out the extent of the injury. But she was fantastic last night. The cross in for the second goal, the drop of the shoulder. Mm. Blackstenius, who was missing a lot of chances, couldn't miss that, headed in. Then McCabe nearly scored one of the goals of the season in the second half when she cut in twice from the left wing. And right-footed shot went wide of the near post, but was brilliant. And then the 87th minute clash with Emlyn Loren, the Bayern Munich substitute. You'll see it in the rounds. Again on screen here, if you can see it, you can see the clash of the feet between both players. So hopefully it's just an impact injury, i.e. badly bruised is probably the best case, or maybe a slight fracture or something. But look, it's all speculation at the moment until we see the scan.
Mark McCann was making the point there on that tweet that similar injury to Evan Ferguson's, obviously left in a boot. He was back 10 days, 14 days later. So we'd actually... Look, obviously you want your best players to play in the friendlies for Ireland and for them to get into a groove. But at the same time, if somebody else has to step in and step up and be a leader for us over the friendlies, it's not a complete disaster. You would take missing the friendlies as opposed to missing any time in the World Cup, obviously.
Could be like a Johnny Sexton. Don't play. Please don't play for Leinster for the rest of the season. Just play for the World Cup. Kitty, even if you're fine, Kitty, just don't play anymore. Maybe play the World Cup warm-up games.
I'm definitely glass half fulling this morning. So we'll talk more about that a little bit later on. But a big win for Arsenal. Hopefully she's back for this semi-final, two legs. And hopefully, you know, she's heading into the World Cup with the... Champions League medal winner in her pocket, which would be fairly sensational. There's a couple of other things I want to talk about. Marcus Cashford, right? This is the back page of the Mirror.
See what they did there.
United hesitate. Tab of the morning to you. Maybe not. United hesitate as England ace asks for 500 grand per week to stay at Old Trafford, right? So Marcus Rashford, you said, took to Instagram?
Yeah, he took to Instagram to deny these reports, I guess, if you want to call them reports. He said...
That's definitely a report.
Well, he said last night, just before this one starts to do the rounds, it's complete nonsense. The club and myself have been respectful to one another, and that's how it will remain. My focus is purely on finishing as well as possible in the league and winning trophies.
Is Marcus Rashford within his rights to ask for 500 grand a week? Bearing in mind where we are with respect to how much people are making at various clubs around the world.
And the potential sale of the club. I don't know, does that mean it's a good time or a bad time to ask for more money? I don't know. It depends who comes in, I guess.
But well, it's a good question, right? Because if you're bidding to buy the club and your best player this season is on the way out, you're like, hang on a second, just protect my assets there. Or you're like, well, we'll take the money from the sale. Who would take the cash from any sale? Would that be the last bit of money pocketed by the outgoing crew, or, you know? So all of that would need to be worked out in the buyer-seller agreement thing.
Well, he's the number one name at the club, so the prospective new owners need to be like, well, just double-checking here. Is Marcus Rashford all right? Is his wage situation okay? Is his contract up for, like, I mean, will he stay? It's similar to a manager taking over at Tottenham and, as you said, deciding and focusing on whether or not Harry Kane will be there next season, because you don't want to be the man who takes over and he leaves. So I think it's the same in the Rashford situation. You got to just double check.
I think first off, like $500,000, right? It seems like an awful lot of money, but it's not an awful lot of money compared to what some of the other players in world football are getting paid at the moment, and particularly in the form that he's in. So now is the time. It wouldn't be that outrageous, I guess, is what I'm saying, for him to be asking for $500,000.
No,
it wouldn't be that outrageous, Man United, to pay something close to that. Would it?
No.
See, the thing is he going to play at this level for the rest of his career? If he does, then you're thinking, I don't care, because he'll qualify us for the Champions League season after season with 27, 30, 35 goals a year.
You know what's really smart? Because he probably will get something like $500,000 a week in his new contract, because he's come out and said, oh, that's ridiculous that I asked for that. I would never ask for that. What are you on about? And then United were like, actually, Marcus, you're so humble and you're so brilliant. You are worth it.
If you're Paris Saint-Germain, and you're saying they're only going to pay him $300,000 or $400,000, we can do that.
Yeah.
Are you thinking, or if you're Real Madrid, are you like, why would we sign somebody who's older for more money when we can get this guy?
He's 25, Rashford.
Again, it's really good positioning for Marcus Rashford, I would say, and I think he's within his rights. I think Man United are within their rights to pay it.
Oh yeah,
that'd be about market value at the moment. I realise a lot of people are going to be in the comments going, "Oh, this is disgusting! It's too much money. Think of all the stuff." I'm like, "Yeah, okay, I understand, but this is the entertainment industry, and they charge the amount that they are worth because the club is making bank. The club is making lots of money. I mean, it's probably a bad thing these days with all the banks failing.
Of course,
anyway.
they can United can afford to pay them $500,000 a week. Let's be honest, and I think they might well do. It was interesting that he. Was it you saying, Colm, about Rashford's injury, the international break? No, I thought I saw someone talking about the fact that he was injured, and some people were suggesting, you know, he probably needed this time regardless.
Well, he was in New York hanging out, wasn't
Gareth
he?
Gareth Southgate had to address that, yeah.
Yeah, which is interesting.
But he played it down, you know, he said, Rashford is unavailable, he's free to do what he wants in that time.
Fair enough.
In New York. It's just not a great look, I suppose, if you're trying to get at him, but...
Well, it's better luck than, you see, Alejandro Garnacho the other day got a bit of stick for, what's the laughing gas, is it? Nitrous oxide?
Oh, yes.
So, I don't know why young footballers get involved in this nitrous oxide stuff, but like, he was just sitting in his car. It's not like he was off in Marbella in a bar taking it. It was like, Alejandro, you're in your car, man.
Yeah, he just needs to relax in a highly pressurized environment.
Chill out, yeah, exactly.
But Rashford, to me, is funny. So another year to go on the contract. Like you said, Shane, if he was on about that already, this wouldn't even be a story. It's like $500,000, that's probably about right. He's United's best striker. And then, but I always think of Rashford, I'm not quite sure about where his status lies for certain. Yeah. I don't know if he's world class. I've never really, never really fell down on either side. I thought the criticism he got last season was probably over the top because he was just one of many who was in a malaise. But with Rashford, I find, the one thing I really admire about him is his finishing ability and the assuredness that he strikes off his right foot, and it's almost always low and hard into the bottom corners. Like Robbie Fowler said, he always said that it wasn't about necessarily hitting as hard as he can, it was just precision, and he's precision with a little bit of kind of Alan Shearer type power. That's great. He's very good at cutting in from the left hand side, but oftentimes he's really quiet, like he can be pretty anonymous, and I just I'm not quite sure in the pantheon of great modern strikers where he lies.
I think this season he has proved he's world class.
Like, can we just have a quick moment? What do you mean by world class?
He's not an unpredictable footballer. He's very predictable.
No. You answer the question.
Yeah, he will show a defender what he's going to do and then do it.
No, but the descriptor world class means something different to everybody. Specifically,
if you're towards the top end of the Premier League goal scoring charts at the end of a season, that would make you a world class footballer.
Okay, so you mean in like the top tier of footballers in the world in their position is what you mean?
Yeah.
And that tier, how big a tier is it?
There are maybe 20 strikers, I would say, that are world class.
Okay, well, this is a completely different definition from most people when it comes to world class. Most people, when they say world class, there's a world 11 picked, he's in the team.
Right, yeah.
That's what. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that, but a lot of people, and I've come to accept that everybody else agrees with that, and so therefore, I would have said he's in that tier of strikers who, if you're picking a team and you're subbing somebody in and out, they're at a similar level. So if you're picking a team of world players, he's not in that first 11. He isn't. Like, you know, there are players who are ahead of him, but he's getting very close to it at this stage.
I would say
this season, if he does this next season and his back-to-back seasons, you'd be like, okay, but he's not Haaland.
World class is a player who is so clearly above all those around him, and there are very few. And that, for me, is the definition of world class.
So
for example, Kylian
Mbappe
the other day at the Aviva was very, very quiet. Just Kenny Cunningham says, "Who was that guy wearing the Mbappe jersey?" Right?
Yeah.
But do you remember that one time when he got the ball in the first half and he destroyed Ireland's defence?
Yeah.
That's what I would consider world class.
So how many of those players are there in the world at any one time? Are you? Is it? It's a malleable number.
Handful.
Because most people have this ridiculous notion that you can only say like three or four. There's only three or four footballers in the world that are world class. But I think that's ridiculous. Any footballer who, and granted in an industry with a lot of money, is offered or there's discussion around him maybe making £500,000 sterling a week to do what he does. That means you're world class at what you do.
Well, there's a few people in the comments here questioning the legitimacy of him being on £500,000. He's not quite there yet. Also, by the way, when I think of world class, I unfairly think of attacking players all the time, final third players, which is unfair because if you're a goalkeeper, how are you supposed to stand out above the rest? But we saw that when Alisson Becker makes a fool of hard shots at him.
Yeah.
Or Ederson.
Courtois,
as we saw.
You can't have three goalkeepers who are world class. You can only have one. That's the thing. In the team, it's like you're picking nits, right?
Well, is Ederson... a world class player who can't get into his national side, like is he one of the very few?
I prefer Ederson to Alisson.
But his distribution
is so important. Yeah. Now look, Alisson's very good. As we said, we're picking it here. Look, I think that Rashford is in the top tier this season, and this is a complete turnaround. Obviously, at the start of the year, I was like, sell him, cash in, absolutely. At this stage, if Paris Saint-Germain want to pay you 45, 50 million, you've got to take that money because it looks like he's never going to fulfil his potential. And then this year, he's exploded. So it just goes to show you what a good manager can do. And I think Man United needs to spend the money and go, this is the most important thing we have. And also, from a bargaining position, if you look around at the other striking options that Manchester United currently have, they have somebody they can't pick. They have a guy on loan who isn't really top tier Champions League, Premier League class in Weghorst. They have an injury prone striker who was on loan and then gets back in and is injured as soon as he gets back in the team. And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
It's Marcus Rashford after that. Am I missing anybody?
But he's taking on the mantle. Like, you know, imagine Rashford wasn't playing well this season, given the ills and travails that you've mentioned there. Like, if he continues to score goals between now and the end of the season, and say United hypothetically win the FA Cup and the Europa League, get top four, and they've already secured the Carabao Cup.
Yeah.
So if he with his goals helps leads them to three trophies and a top four finish, that would be an unbelievable season. That's all hypothetical, but I mean,
sorry, Jerry, did you mention Anthony Martial there in your list of strikers?
He was the injury prone.
I often can't split those two players in ability throughout the years at United. Now, I'm not obviously talking about this season where Rashford's clearly ahead and Martial's just not around. And I'm very surprised Martial came back to the club after his loan spell at Sevilla last season.
Which was
really surprising to see him back.
Yeah.
But throughout the years, very similar players in my mind. And that's another reason with Rashford, I just can't quite see him sticking out. Yeah, I think they're very similar levels of ability and very similar type of players.
You watch way more of Manchester United than I do. I don't see every single second of every single game. But I've never seen Martial put in the level of consistency or even the explosiveness and the close ball control that Rashford has or the effectiveness. Like, Rashford understands he's really fast and has an ability, and Martial still seems to be figuring out what it is that he's good at. And I think there's a vast difference between their effectiveness. Maybe Martial has similar levels of potential, but I still haven't seen that. So I would have said that, like, one is a clear failure and has been for a long period of time. Whereas even when Rashford wasn't getting in the team and Mourinho was saying he's not ready for it, there would be glimpses where you'd be like, holy shit, this guy could be explosive.
You know? Like, everyone remembers Martial's start to his Manchester United career, that famous goal against Liverpool at Old Trafford, and a few seasons ago he's at Stamford Bridge, and a lovely kind of close control finish in a very high-pressurised game. So the close control thing I disagree with slightly, in that I think his technique is very good. The problem with Martial is that he's more than happy to be anonymous. More than happy.
And
you know, it doesn't seem to really...
Lazy as well. Yeah. He has been...
I think
he's improved in that regard.
I think his language style betrays the fact that he actually does work quite hard. and he has a kind of
see, Berbatov had the language style, but I think Martial is more lazy than Berbatov. Now he's definitely improved under Ten Hag, because you have to, but I think there's talk from Ten Hag this week that he might be back in for the Newcastle game on Sunday. They're not going to rush him back, so if he over the coming days doesn't make it, he doesn't make it. But I think he comes straight back into the team in front of Weghorst in that central position.
Yeah, yeah.
And you play Rashford on the left, straight in for Weghorst. Like, there's no question.
Sorry, and just on Martial, like, I'd have absolutely no problem with him leaving the club. Like, I think his time is done at United. But if you look at the stats here, for the most Premier League goals scored between the two of them, they're actually level, would you believe, in terms of for a single season. So in 2019-20, Martial scored 17 Premier League goals. And that, at the time of speaking, is Rashford's top scoring as well.
He's going to
surpass that this season, 14 already.
Yeah.
But they actually scored the same amount in the same season. So I can't, I throughout the years, I've always thought they're very similar in terms of where they stand in the United hierarchy.
Okay, well, in that instance, and you don't actually think he's worth paying the $500,000 a week to, because you could pay that $500,000 a week to somebody else, and like, you would be getting a world-class striker at that price.
Well, Harry Kane and Victor Osimhen, how much money are they going to want? Probably something similar. Surely.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, the $500,000, like, that, it wouldn't bother me at all if that's what Rashford was on.
No.
I mean, he's scoring the goals. I just think, like, I don't correlate $500,000 a week with necessarily having to be world class. That's the clubs are going to play who they think their most important players are.
Well,
I think it's a different discussion about the world class status.
Yeah, in a way, right? But they did massively overpay Alexis Sanchez, which ruined the dressing room economics, and they all compare. Like,
okay, yeah, but that era is behind the club.
Well,
you know, they're moving on from that, and that, like, that was a massive mistake. Like, the whole thing was an unmitigated disaster.
But
but that's the past.
Well, I'm not sure. It's very easy to fall back into that. You know, the circus is always just beneath the surface at Manchester United, as Roy Keane pointed out. And so I don't know. I think that, like, there is a big decision to make. Personally, I'd pay the money at this stage because he seems to be worth it. But equally, if they decide that they're going to cash in and there's like $100 million on the table from Paris Saint-Germain or Real Madrid, you're like, yeah, okay, we'll take that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. They're not in a bad situation here.
He's a Withenshaw boy. I don't think he'll want to leave Manchester United, is the point. Now, if he doesn't get the money he wants, and look, he's denied that wanting the $500,000, but he'll probably get it. Like,
maybe he takes 475.
Maybe, yeah.
No, that's what I mean. That's what I mean by this, because he's come out and denied the story, so this is not true at all, and that could very well end up him getting the money
or something close to
linked with or close with. He may take a lead chain out of a former Manchester United greats book, like Mark Hughes in the 1980s, and go abroad for a couple of years, Bayern Munich, Barcelona, and return to the club. It's a bit of a hero. If I was Rashford representatives, I'd be really encouraging that. Go abroad.
Really?
Yeah, I think he would clean up abroad.
Here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock. Siobhan Ahern is going to talk to us about Arsenal's victory last night, the latest with Katie McCabe as well. Stewie Byrne's going to join us today, 25, to preview the weekend's League of Ireland action and to talk about the news that Virgin Media are going to show Rovers and Bowes. Sports news with Colin Lanley at 8:45. Conor Moore is this week's episode of You Had to Be There, aka Conor Sketches, and Dan McDonnell, I think, putting a tin hat on the Ireland situation, but I'm not entirely sure because I missed the football show last night. But anyway, some other very quick things to talk about. Gary Breen is in the Indo and the Herald today, and he's actually offering a fairly throaty defence of Stephen Kenny, obviously saying that they still need results, but very clearly saying this was different. It felt measured, controlled and disciplined from a team that was obviously well coached. There's no shame attached to such tactics, despite misguided purists preaching otherwise. We were resolute, denied space for Mbappe, who himself was very different to World Cup Mbappe, while regularly countering through the brilliant Chidoze Egbene. And he disagrees with Kerr and disagrees with Martin O'Neill about the substitutes. He says he thinks that, and he said he called it in commentary, and that actually they appeared planned and thought out, not reactionary off the cuff. I called them in commentary prior to them happening, yet I didn't believe they were overdue. So he says it was just right. And I think, ultimately, this is the most supportive that we've seen any of that former crew who played under Mick McCarthy or played in the O'Neill era being of Stephen Kenny. And it's just interesting because we're obviously involved. We've all been aware of the culture war between those people who think that Stephen Kenny's doing the right thing and those people who think that we should be, you know, whatever, however you want to phrase that. You know the end of that sentence. And certainly I thought that Kerr went way too far. I thought Damien Delaney went way too far. And I think Richard Dunn's kind of a bit in the middle. I didn't see the full Richard Dunn interview now, so I need to go back and watch that. But they've definitely been, you would say, critical of the performances and the results, whereas and so had Gary Breen up to this point. But it's like, I can see what they're doing here. So I don't know. It's just an interesting little straw in the wind.
I don't see how you can be critical of the performance the other night in any
well,
any
they didn't
way,
win the game. Shame.
Well, no, I know we didn't win the game, but the performance. Yeah, if we get the goal at the end.
Well, the performance was the same as it's always been. You're just hoofing the ball forward to the big lad at the front for the last 10 minutes. That's what the argument is,
yeah,
right?
Of course, yeah,
I mean, I disagree with that, but that's what people are saying.
Well, I think what irks me about it is that they cited the result as being the problem. Oh, we lost.
Yeah,
it's like probably the best side in the world against a team, as we said yesterday, full of championship players.
Yeah, it was almost perfect
like,
game management.
What do people expect? Like,
yeah, yeah. If Josh Cullen doesn't pass that ball across his own box,
if Nathan Collins' header goes in, which it would 9.5 times out of 10,
the entire conversation is different.
I'm very frustrated by that analysis of it. I was interested to hear it for sure, but we have this like the cheek of us like to expect that we are going to compete with this France side.
Yeah.
Like that we should be getting a result and it should be at home. I know losing at home is not a good look and we may live to regret it. But like, lads, look at the current squad. Like,
if we lose to Greece, the conversation's different. I get that about Stephen Kenny.
Greece aren't the bad side either.
No, they're not. But those are the games you need to be winning to, or getting a point from away to have a serious, you know, tilt at a qualification.
If we lose a game where we play really well and there's a mistake or there's a bad refereeing decision and there's still a pattern of play emerging and we then, like, we're not, until we're out of this group and until we can't no longer qualify for the Euros, you've got to continue to see signs of progress. We saw signs of progress the other night. Like, we can't get too carried away because we have seen these one-off performances before. I agree with Gary Breen that I think there's a significant difference in this one and that there was a structure, there was a plan. We're not desperately hoofing the ball away anytime we get it. We actually created one of our best chances from a moment of significant danger. Like in commentary, I think Darmian was like, oh, this is a bit dangerous. And then all of a sudden, ball's down the far end. And if Knight just gets a shot away, I think if Knight's playing at a higher level, he gets a shot away. But Griezmann gets the block. And anyway.
Sorry, he's also blooding players. But the fact that the last international window, the Armenia game, and was it Portugal or whoever we played, Will Smallbone and Mikey Johnston were two names that weren't even close to discussion. And now all of a sudden, people are like, should they start? Do you know, so there's players coming in constantly. Every single window he seems to bring in a player or two, which is brilliant. So going from not strength to strength, but certainly I'm more optimistic than I would have been maybe in advance of the France game.
OTBAM with Gillette Labs. Got the ultimate shave or your money back Neon Knight edition available now. We need to talk about the Hall of Fame too. I was talking about this in terms of GA and how we should have just put a bit of time and effort into getting it up and running, and it should mean something. In the Premier League, because it's a Premier League Hall of Fame, is it somehow... does it matter less? Is this important? Ferguson and Wenger are the two managers who've just been in, and Ferguson is there pictured in the official photograph pointing at his watch smiling, because like, that's the typical look. It's like, hey look. No, it was like and the Wenger is doing his I've just been sent off polls, which is kind of interesting.
Have you seen Ferguson's acting debut, the Wrexham?
No,
the Wrexham ad. So yesterday or the day before, Wrexham and Manchester United announced a pre-season friendly
in California.
In California, of course. And Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds in a video. They're basically acting out a Zoom call with Alex Ferguson, which is very, very funny. And Ferguson acts quite well in it, I think. He only has one speaking line, but it's very well done. But yeah, Ferguson, he's mellowed. He's 81.
Yeah. He acts quite well. That's interesting. I remember, Ger, when we were talking about Saipan last summer.
You're not supposed to remember stuff that we've said. Colin, that's one of the rules.
Well, this is a good look for you. You were saying, do you remember when Roy Keane did those spate of ads at the turn of the century?
In the gladiator outfits
and
stuff.
Yeah, and I was saying at the time, like,
oh yeah, that one too.
Can you imagine the producer, director saying to Roy, no, Roy, what we want you to do is this, you know, and start acting. And then you were saying, Jerry, was like, no, Roy Keane's an actor. Like, he wants... He appreciates art.
Yeah.
He wants to get involved in this.
And also very coachable.
And Ferguson, you were saying, Shane, is a good actor. And these two are just so similar, Keane and Ferguson. They have never-ending similarities, these two. Seemingly hard nuts to crack, but if you really get into the right spirit of them, they're actually very creative and open to the arts.
Yeah, I do think Roy Keane's a far better, more engaging pundit than Ferguson was. He's funnier. He's got a better sense of comic timing. Ferguson... slightly better manager, you'd have to say. Yeah. Going out on a limb here, he's a better manager.
Ferguson did very little punditry.
True, yeah.
He's no good at it.
When he was an active manager. Was Euro 96, I think. I'd love if anyone in the comments could tell me, when was Alex Ferguson a pundit on TV? when he was an active manager. And I think it was Euro 96 and BBC was the last time.
Right. Jesus.
I think.
Sure, it just wouldn't be his. Like, because he's not even a coach. He's a manager of people, essentially.
But you know? Would think he'd have a fascinating insight.
Yeah. I don't want this to sound like a morbid thought. It's not necessarily a morbid thought. But part of me, and look, hopefully, touch wood, Alex Ferguson has many more years left on this planet. But I would love, before he shuffles off this mortal coil, I would love Alex Ferguson and Roy Keane to meet up, have a dinner, a couple of drinks, reminisce. Wasn't that all a bit mad? And maybe put up a little photograph together with a smile. Like, it would just be nice, you know? Because I don't want it to. Someday we're going to wake up to the unfortunate news that Alex Ferguson is no longer with us. And when that happens, I'd like to think you put everything behind you, you know? Roy Keane and him should have a little get together. I'm not saying it's going to happen. It's not. But like,
Homer Simpson has a line about, and then we could all go and live in La La Land. That's like, well done, Shane. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, it'd be nice.
What would you prefer to
timeline cleanser?
A reunion of Alex Ferguson and Roy Keane or Noel Gallagher and Liam Gallagher?
Oh, both. I mean, both.
And what would you prefer?
Well, that's family. That's even, they got to do. If you fall out of family, you gotta sort that out, you know? So, both actually. Yeah, both. It'd be brilliant.
What's more likely to happen?
Probably the Oasis one, I think.
Oh, definitely. There's a lot of money involved, right? And your man's got divorced, or is getting divorced, right?
No, I got divorced.
There you go.
All of a sudden, he's like, yeah, I get Liam to call my people. But imagine, all of a sudden, he's up for it.
Imagine Netflix got onto Roy and Alex.
Well, that was
lads, here is a large sum of money.
Well, that's where I was going with this. What would it take to get Ferguson and Keane back? The two most stubborn people in sport history. Yeah,
they're too stubborn.
Is there anything?
No.
Anything that will enable those two to go in the same room together.
Also,
what's fascinating to me is that they're often in the same place.
A lot of things
Roy Keane, Alex Ferguson and Old Trafford together an awful lot.
Constantly.
A lot of things can bring motivation, which we've seen before. Wasn't there a horse involved at some point?
That's where it all started.
A very, very important part of Manchester United's history.
That's where it all started.
And that wasn't about like, I love seeing my colours in the parade ring. Oh, that's great. It was about horse semen. That's what that was all about. The gallons and gallons and gallons. It turned out not to be very valuable horse semen.
For anyone watching OTB this morning, if you had gallons of horse semen on your bingo card for this morning, take it off.
Right.
Enjoy your breakfast.
Does the Hall of Fame matter was the original point. I do think that when Keane was talking recently after the League Cup win and the defeat, was it immediately after? I can't even remember when it was. Was it the Cup game that they got beaten in? When did they perform absolutely abysmally in
Liverpool 7-0 this season?
Which?
Was it 7-0? Was there something else after that? Anyway, Keane was talking about the soap opera is always just below. The circus is always just there. And he'd be a little bit concerned about it. Was it after the 7-0? Because he was on that night.
He was, yeah. It could have been that night, yeah.
But Ferguson's greatest achievement was managing to kill the circus. Like, chop it from wherever it needed to be. And that's why when you're making the point that that the banter bus era is over, it isn't. It isn't. It's always just one step away. Like Bayern Munich had the FC Hollywood thing, and then eventually they managed to fix that. And a lot of the people who were architects of that turned out not to be great people, and the law caught up with them. Yeah. So, like, it's very difficult to manage something like this properly to get to a point where you're harvesting trophies and maybe that's Pep's greatest achievement, is managing to keep all those egos intact with all the billions that he's had at his advantage. But I do think that, like, we probably underestimate that part of Ferguson, and of course he should be in the Hall of Fame. I just wonder, does it matter?
I saw the Sky Sports News yellow bar ticker yesterday afternoon. I was like, what's this? Everyone's leaning over.
Yeah.
And then I saw Alex Ferguson and Arsene Wenger inducted into the Premier League Hall of Fame. I thought that happened about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, so it doesn't really, it's just a formality. Like, everyone understands that that's where we're going.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jonathan Kennedy, for answering my question. The year after Newcastle blew the league to Man U, ITV had Ferguson and Keegan on together for the Euros.
Yeah.
So I do think that was the last time. Also, Spectacor, you've had your coffee this morning. You are all over these comments.
Man.
I was looking at Spectacor the whole time.
Sorry, very briefly. You mentioned the GA should have a Hall of Fame. Who's your first three
names? They do.
They do have one?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, but
there's the thing. I think you can't have a first three. You've got to have a first 150.
Yeah,
right?
Sorry, yeah.
And you just get everybody in at the start, and then every year it becomes a thing. So in the NFL, I think there's a 7 or 8 year window where you can't be inducted, and then you become eligible for the first time, and then there's first ballot Hall of Famers who get in. And that's why, because they've been doing it for so long, and because it's such an American thing, it obviously, it does matter. And it's a way of it's a way of getting your party songs into the Hall of Fame, and everybody goes, yeah, that was actually really, that really
well deserved, by the way.
You know, I'm, this really matters to me in a way that, like, it's just different. And they tried to get it going, and I don't know if it's still there or not, but so, like, obviously, you got to go back historically and get all your Sean Purcells and
Christy and, Rings in there.
Yeah, exactly. But you just do that, and like, and then you get like a content series off the back of that.
And then you can get to your Conor McManus's eventually.
I did see somebody else doing a Mount Rushmore the other day. I was like, what? That's a great idea. That's an excellent idea.
Nice, I like it.
Yeah. And we didn't invent it.
No, of course.
Like, I'm not saying we invented it, but like, it's a little bit.
America invented
it. It's a little bit. Yeah. Wasn't it? Whatever.
Yeah, didn't Trump try and get his name, his face as the fifth one? I think he broached the idea. So maybe some people can get onto us, and if there's a sports person in a certain county. Trump was, I think he broached the idea of getting that.
Judd Trump, the snooker player.
Yeah. I really could see the Donald.
Sorry,
doing that.
Donald. Yeah, it was Donald, yeah. Donald Trump.
You got distracted by SpectreCore again, did you?
I was producing.
All right, very good.
Yeah.
We're not doing Paratici's video here, are we?
Well, I don't think so.
Okay, great. It's 8 o'clock this morning here on OTBAM. We also have had our coffee. We're live every morning with Gillette Labs. Get the ultimate shaver, your money back, Neon Night Edition available now. During the outbreak, a clip from the latest episode of the Koi Gig Pod. You should search Koi Gig wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to it. You'll also find it in our football feed. But this is Emma Byrne telling Kathleen and Karen who she least liked facing in penalties whenever she was playing. The Koi Gig Pod on Off the Ball is in association with Cadbury FC, official snack partner to the Republic of Ireland Women's National Team. We're back after the break with Kathleen herself and football broadcaster Siobhan Hearn.
OTB AM.
The Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball.
Off the Ball Daily. A home for your favourite podcasts from Off the Ball. The performance rankings, you had to be there, the crappy quiz, and a slight tangent.
Ireland against Scotland in World Cup B.
In Chile.
The World Plate. World Cup B is growing on me. As a name.
Subscribe to the Off the Ball Daily podcast feed right now.
Emma, was there ever anyone that you particularly didn't like when you were coming up against them on penalties? Is there any teams that had, in the AFC, different teams who have either the goalkeeper themselves or the people who are taking the shots have certain tactics to kind of put each other off?
I didn't like being in goal when Farrah Williams was taking a penalty because she's just quality. She just puts it in the corner and high. She knew my weak points. But I quite liked penalties when I was playing. I enjoyed them.
The pressure is on the taker, not on the keeper.
Yeah. And then, I didn't find them easy, but it was easy to try and trick players into like just a little drop of the shoulder, just as they're going to take it. Like there's been a few players that have come up to me and said, I was going in a direction, then I seen you, just drop your shoulder. And I was like, yeah, but I was never going that way. I was always going to go the opposite way. So when people started copping onto what I was doing, it became very difficult for me. So I saved most of my penalties in the earlier years of my career, that's for sure.
The Heineken Champions Cup is back. Leinster take on Ulster in the round of 16, Saturday, April 1st at 5:30 in the Aviva Stadium. Join the Sea of Blue for this massive interprovincial clash. Tickets on sale now at leinsterrugby.ie. Terms and conditions apply.
OTB AM with Gillette Labs. Get the ultimate shave or your money back. Neon Night Edition available now.
It's 3 minutes past eight. Siobhan Hearn, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, Trips. I'm well. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. A little bit concerned about...
I know. I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. So a lot of people won't have seen this, right? The footage obviously did the rounds on Irish football Twitter immediately last night. Katie McKay was injured about 86 minutes into the game. At that stage, it looked like Arsenal were home and hosed, and they were, having beaten now Bayern Munich 2-0 in the second leg to win 2-1 on aggregate. How bad was the challenge?
It was unfortunate how it looked, and I actually think I was watching the game with Rusha, my sister, and at that point I went, oh, she actually looks like she's struggling a little bit here. Now, we were joking that, well, if we know Katie McCabe, the way we know Katie McCabe, she loves a little roll about the floor. And then actually when we saw the replay, we thought, oh no, she's actually really hurt here. And I think that's the first time I've seen Katie go off. in a long, long time. And she looked sore. You could tell that she was struggling. It looks like a sore one. And the challenge doesn't look good. But fingers crossed she gets positive news today from her scan.
Yeah, in fairness, she obviously gets carried off the field. And then later there's a photograph of her on Twitter. She's smiling with the boot. We've got it up there now. She is smiling and the boot is on and you're kind of hoping. I mean, I know the adrenaline after a victory like that because you're through to the semi-final of the Champions League. So, yeah, fingers crossed she's actually all right.
Yeah, I mean, listen, massive night for the Gunners getting through. And I think you're right. I think adrenaline will probably have seen Katie through last night. And smiling and having the crack. But if I see another boot, honestly, ahead of this World Cup, I'll just start pulling my hair out now. But I mean, when I saw the boot in the picture, I thought, oh, that's not, I didn't expect to see that. But I know as much as you guys do, it was sore last night. She did send a message saying her foot was very sore, but she will have a scan today. And the club should give us an update in due course, but fingers crossed, it's just, I mean, it looked sore. I saw a picture, it looked like a bad bruise in a little cut, but sometimes I think that can that be better, you know, instead of muscle, you know, so I want to take a positive from that, but I'm no doctor and I don't know how she'll be, but I imagine this morning her foot will be pretty painful.
Yeah, our amateur doctors, most notably Colm, was like, oh, it looked more like a contact injury as opposed to ligaments. We're like, well, good man, physio, Colm. But actually, you know, we've watched a lot of football, we've seen a lot of these injuries, and fingers crossed. Somebody was comparing it to Evan Ferguson. Obviously, we had footage of him in a boot in the aftermath of the Liverpool game, and he was grand. So,
that's what we're hoping for. And that's the thing, I mean, I remember when Ruscha had broke her foot in Finland in that playoff game, that was the same kind of contact kind of thing, like the stud to the foot. But actually, when I saw the picture of Katie's, I thought, oh, that does look quite, it looked sore. You know, she had a little cut and a bruise. And I thought, okay, maybe that's more of a positive thing to take from this. But we will see. We will find out in due course. Fingers crossed for her.
Kathleen, what kind of performance was it before that? Because it looks like from all the reports, Katie McCabe was having an absolute stormer.
Oh, completely. I mean, the setup for the Black Steinius goal was beautiful. Like, it was a classic Katie McCabe pinpoint cross. You couldn't help, like, you'd have to try hard to miss off that sort of cross. I think Arsenal, not that they'll be disappointed, because obviously they went through, but they probably should have scored a couple more goals. Like, they definitely had the opportunities. I think for them, it was a much more complete performance than the week before in Bayern Munich, in that they were actually able to get goals, which has always been something that they've struggled in these Champions League games, where they've put up a good performance, but they haven't been able to score those goals. Great to see Frieda Malm scoring as well. She kind of had a bit of a strange patch there, where she was really, really good when she came in after Miedema getting their injuries, and then tapered off a little bit and is kind of coming back up on a high now. The big thing for me after last night is that I think it kind of leaves Arsenal in the same position that Chelsea were last week, in that they had a big performance, a great game, everyone was on a high, but lost a couple of big players' injuries. So, like, chances are Katie, no matter what the injury is, isn't going to play this weekend against City. Kim Little also went off after 11 minutes, and that's probably going to be a big worry for them, Siobhan.
Yeah, I mean, and they've got Manchester City, and Manchester City are fresh off that 2-0 win over Chelsea, and are just on this brilliant form at this moment in time. I agree with you, Kathleen. I don't know how both of those players will be back and available this weekend. He's going to have to turn to his bench, and they're going to have to dig deep. I mean, the beauty of it is they're at Boreham Wood. They know that ground so well. They know that atmosphere so well. They know what they have to do against Manchester City. The thing is, in my personal opinion, I think Manchester City can sometimes play the best football. And where Arsenal have sometimes been lacking, especially at this point in the season, Manchester City are doing by the bucket load, and that's banging in the goals. So they'll have their work cut out for them this Sunday. But fingers crossed they can get a win and see them push up that table again. But last night, huge win, and could almost be one of the highlights of their season so far.
It's kind of funny, I think, when you look at the title race, and obviously it's so close at the moment, and you look at every other team. So you look at City, they have Bonnie Shaw. You look at United, they have, you know, Ella Toon, Alessia Russo. You look at Chelsea, they have Sam Kerr. They all have their kind of defined goal scorers, whereas Arsenal don't really have that so much this year. I know like Blackstenius was supposed to be that player, but I mean, I think last night they had 14 shots and seven of those were on target, seven of those were off target. And that's probably a good statistic for Arsenal this season in terms of their shot ratio. They're very good at getting the ball, holding the ball, but they don't really have that like out and out goal scoring ability and in the same way as the other teams. Is that something, do you think, that's going to hamper them a little bit in this running? Because I think they've City and then they've United next and they still have another big game left to play before the end of the season. So like they have quite a difficult run in.
Yeah, they've still got, I think they've still got Chelsea second last game and then they've got Villa on the last game of the season. Yeah, I completely agree with you. However, what I would say is I feel that they've been hampered already by this and now I feel that they're starting to come good ever so slightly. I think Stina Blackstenius, is that 4-4 possibly for her? Starting to find that little bit of confidence, just starting to hit the ground running again and just finding that confidence in front of goal. I think Caitlin Ford, you know, you can rely on her for a few goals. And she's looked so brilliant this season. And I can sometimes think, okay, just stick striker, you know, Caitlin into that striker position. And you can rely on her for goals. Frieda Manum, when she has games like she has last night and she can hit those rockets, you never know what you're going to get. But the thing is, there's inconsistencies there in that forward line from Arsenal. And that's where the problems lie. You know, they're not getting goals and they're without Vivian Miedema and Beth Mead where their goals were coming from. So for me, I do have to look and go, you give them that injury grace, especially when you go up against Manchester City. I went to the North London Derby last week and they were a perfect performance, but I don't think you can look at, no disrespect, look at Spurs and say, aye, well, you know, you can really take huge positives from that performance because everyone's been taking points off of Spurs. Manchester City are 14 games unbeaten now. You know, Arsenal are going to have to really dig deep and finish their chances, every single one of them they get.
You mentioned the Frieda Manum rocket there, Siobhan. I mean, if I had my way, we would just spend 20 minutes talking about that goal, and I'm just waiting for The Athletic to do, or someone to do a deep dive on the intricacies of every single move in the build-up. Even the Leah Williamson flick was just ridiculous. Maybe it was the camera angle, like just the satisfaction of how it went in, but it was some goal.
Yeah, no, I mean, she does that. Frieda does that how many times? In fact, she's a bit like Katie McCabe in the fact that she can just pull off these worldies, you know, now and then. And Katie nearly had one last night as well, didn't she? She went off on that lovely little run down the left and I thought, oh, and it just went wide of the post. But, you know, Frieda Manum, I think, has had a good season. And as you mentioned there, she's had this slight dip. But when she's on form, for me, she's just one of the best, you know, and she's a big physical player as well. And yeah, that goal was absolutely terrific. And then also she had that beautiful moment. I think it was it Pulova crossed it in and then Frieda Manum did that back heel, you know, to Caitlin Ford, and Caitlin she should have just dinked it over the keeper, but she put it over the bar and I was just like, oh my God, that would have been such a beautiful moment had that come through, but it didn't. But Frieda Manum had a great game last night. Whatever it is those players took to the Emirates last night, if they bring that, okay, they might be missing Kate McCabe, they might be missing Kim Little. If they bring that to Manchester City the weekend, they've got it all. You know, on their day, they can beat anyone.
Is this a bit of a surprise? Like, in the build-up, people were saying, oh, they don't think they're actually going to win the tournament outright. But now you're in a semi-final, you've got to be thinking, well, why not?
Do you know what? I work closely with the UWCL and I have seen some outstanding performances. And it's tournament cup football always changes things. But Arsenal surprised me that last night. And I think if they get Wolfsburg or PSG, whoever that may be, we'll find out their fate tonight. Oh, it's going to be a huge game. You know, we know what Wolfsburg can do. Some people are tipping them as the winners of the competition this time round. PSG have been very, very good, but they're still not there just yet. So I don't know what's the kind of side of that draw. You know, I would say if they can get PSG, they can make it to a final and I look and go, wow, what a season. What a season for Arsenal. And I don't know where they go in the league from here. You know, the league is so tight at this moment in time. But as we've mentioned, you know, Chelsea, okay, they've dropped the points once again and that shocks me. And Chelsea will be putting everything in their game against Lyon tonight, that they might have tired legs at the weekend once again and they might further drop points. But Arsenal have got City, you know, and I look and go, if they can put all the focus into the Champions League, get to a final, you know, it would be huge competition, but it would be a huge moment for that squad. They've already picked up one piece of silverware. They've got the buzz for it. They're a good squad. You know, they've got a good manager. They've got it all. You know, Arsenal do have it all. okay, we've mentioned earlier on they're lacking in goals, but I think they have so much to offer and it's a great team. And imagine, just imagine they get to Eindhoven. I mean, what an incredible sight that would be.
Yeah, and imagine that, like, Katie Taylor, or Katie, Katie McCabe was linked with a move away. It could be one of those great ironies where she ends up staying and they win this and it's the cementing of a great relationship.
It could be. I mean, it absolutely could be. You know, those moments winning silverware will change anybody's, you know, thoughts and or make them feel where they want to be. You can imagine that. We'll wait and see what comes at that point in time and if anything else materialises come the summer. But, you know, Katie's she's got a lot to focus on. You know, I do think I look at being close to some of these players and I look and go, there's a hell of a lot on them, you know, to win each game, to climb back up the table, to stay fit, to focus on a World Cup. And you guys, I want to be full Irish, right? I'll say that right now. But the fact that Ruth and I were speaking about this last night watching the game, she'd watched back the Republic of Ireland, the national anthem, and she's just like, imagine this in Sydney, this moment, you know, playing against Australia, this national anthem. And I think, wow, like all of these players are fighting to get on that plane, you know, to be there in Vera Pauw's squad. And, you know, then moments like last night, Katie picking up that knock, you feel for them, you know, you feel for them. They're really giving it everything that they've got. There's a lot on them. And I just want them to focus on being the best that they can be without putting too much pressure on themselves. But, you know, we're wanting them to win Champions Leagues and climb their way back up the table and go to the World Cup and get out the group. You know, it's a lot on these players. It's going to take a lot of I think, therapy to be ready for those big moments.
It's kind of interesting you were saying about, like, what would this mean for, like, Katie in the summer. But I think, like, generally this is the sort of week that Arsenal will look back as, like, defining on their season, depending on how it goes. Because at the moment, like, they're in a semi-final for the Champions League, technically still in that race in the top four. And they have to play City, they have United coming up, however that semi-final goes. If they don't make it past the semi-final, or even if they make it into final, don't win, if they don't make top three, how are they going to hold on to, like, a certain level of player? Or how are they going to attract the certain level of player? Like, as I was saying earlier, in terms of them maybe not having that out-and-out striker in the way that a lot of other teams do, or have that very established, can get the goals, get the dirty goals that maybe your team is down, but they strike in the ball. And for me, this is going to be the most interesting part of Arsenal's season in terms of the players they're able to keep. You know, like, Minamino's contract was only a year extension. There's a lot of other players whose contracts are coming up for a renewal. There's a lot of players in the league, the likes of Alessio Russo, who Arsenal were interested in January, who are also up for contract renewals in the summer, who they might want to try and attract in. And this could very quickly go from, okay, we're in a title race, we're also in the Champions League race, to our season amounts to a League Cup and nothing else.
I know. Listen, you're saying all the things I think I've been thinking about in my head, you know, the last 24 hours anyway. And Bayern are a good team. And last night I was thinking, well, if they don't get through, you know, Bayern are solid and you can never underestimate the Germans. You know, they're so experienced and they get the job done. Well, Arsenal were the better team last night. And Jonas Edeval had done a press conference last weekend and he did say, on our day, we can beat anyone. And they can, and they've actually shown that at several times now this season. I mean, I was at the Connacht Cup final at Selhurst Park. You know, they wiped the floor with Chelsea, you know, and I would never have said that even at the beginning of this season when Arsenal had Vivian Amir and Beth Mead. I was looking and going, there was something about Chelsea. But listen, they have their own mountains to climb as well. They're wanting to progress in the Champions League. They're wanting to win the league. They're looking for another domestic quadruple or whatever that was they got a couple of seasons ago. Everyone's doing their own thing. And Manchester City are just on this run. Manchester United have surprised everyone. Aston Villa are even doing bits as well. I mean, I don't think they close the gap and get to fourth. But, you know, the league is just strengthening and strengthening and strengthening. And then you get to these competitions like the Champions League, like the Connacht Cup, and those moments for more silverware. Now they've got that buzz from the Connacht Cup final. Now they know that they can beat Chelsea. I think it can go right down to the wire till the end of the season, you know, to those games, that second last game, that last game of the season. It's one of the most exciting title races we've had in the WSL. It keeps it so much more exciting for fans and for anybody wanting to get involved and support women's football, because you've not just got Chelsea-Arsenal. You know, it's changing all of the time. You've got all of these teams now just improving and strengthening and catching up. And that's, for me, what makes the summer even more exciting. Are Arsenal going to nick Alessia Russo? Is she going to come? You know, will Chelsea get in a bidding war for that? What will Katie McCabe do? There's just so much more to focus on now. And I think that's what's the beauty of this league. It's just only going one way now. And, you know, Arsenal are important in this league. So important.
It's good timing after last summer as well. Can we just go back to that moment where you're sitting on the couch watching the anthem? Because everybody's been remarking about, I think it was Elisa Lamb did the anthem?
Yeah.
Yeah. She was amazing. Like, absolutely amazing. And they should just book her for the anthem.
Book her for Sydney? Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Not a bad idea.
Get her on that plane.
I'd say she'd be delighted. So, sometimes the players love that stuff, but sometimes they can feel like, ooh, I recognise now. So obviously it sounds a little bit like Greece is wrestling with that at the moment, the importance of it, but also just leaning in and enjoying it. How do they all make sure that it's just a positive as opposed to pressure? Because, like, I don't know if you ever... The best bit of advice I ever got was like a wedding speech. It was like, everybody in the room wants you to succeed. Everybody watching the match wants this team to just succeed and enjoy it. How do we make sure that they feel that?
Do you know, Rusha's, for me, she's one of the most like measured in our, you know, the way she thinks, the way she tries to better her thinking, the way she works on mindfulness is so important. And I think it's because maybe she's a smidge older. She's been through the million injuries. She was out of the WSL and had to find a way back in. You know, she's had a rough run of luck, Rusha. So I like how she focuses and how can I be better? How can I make sure that I'm thinking the best possible thoughts to better my experience? And, you know, she speaks about the Ukraine game that Ireland had in that playoff where they nearly got to the Euros. And she remembers, she recalls everyone being so nervous that day. She's like, we weren't ever used to being in this experience. We've never been this close. And everybody was on the edge. You know, we weren't prepared for going into that game, for the nerves, for the pressure, for knowing that we were one game away from the Euros. We'd never been there before. Emma Byrne, who I heard on the show earlier on, or, you know, she had been in that position with her squad at the time. They were close to getting a playoff, or did maybe get a playoff. And she said how that now she looks at that moment and the game against Scotland in the actual playoff for the World Cup, Ireland were ready. You know, that they had dealt with those nerves before. They knew the job that they had to do. They knew the occasion. And it was having that experience of losing a game in that high-pressure moment that's helped them get to this point now. And I think that's just such a great way of thinking. You know, the fact that you don't lose, you learn. You know, they've learned so much from that experience. They've got through the playoff. Now they're going to go to a World Cup and they're going to open it. And this is to be the most watched sporting event, I think, in history. And I look and go, this beautiful country with so many incredible sports stars are going to open up the World Cup and just set an example for so many. And hopefully, touch wood, my sister and Katie will be there and all of their friends and Vera. And it's just going to be this beautiful occasion that everybody enjoys and just savours that moment and go, God, we've done it. You know, we've done it. We've made it here. Now let's just be defensively solid and just try and get a couple of goals and beat Australia and get out of the group. You know, Andy, it's going to be so hard, but enjoy it.
You know? You almost made me forget that we actually had to play a match after all that. Oh, yeah. I was like transporting myself to Australia the moment of hearing the national anthem. I was getting the goosebumps and then I was like, oh yeah, we actually have to play Australia.
Good luck with that.
We could just cut it off after the national anthems and just be like, what a great moment.
Let's end it there.
In fairness, their anthem is also pretty good. And how is Risha's injury at the moment?
She's good. She's really, really good. She's still got a bit of wrap around her knee, but she's back on the pitch. You know, fingers crossed she makes it to the squad this weekend. They're playing Chelsea. Aston Villa have Chelsea. Again, Aston Villa having this great season, and I look at her and go, God, it's a shame. You know, you've been injured so much of it, yet your team's flying. But again, she's positive. You know, she's really positive. She's hoping that she's going to get to Vera Pauw's camp because they go to America, I think, on Monday. Don't they? They go to Texas on Monday. So fingers crossed she makes it to that. And fingers crossed, again, she focuses on what's ahead and what's in her control. And that is a World Cup. And the opportunity to be there for Ireland, I think, is just everything she could ever dream of. So she's doing really well. She's recovering nicely and she's in good spirits.
I'm always really interested in that whole evolution of players' embrace of sports psychology. And you're talking about mindfulness there. Are the squad getting helped, you know? Or is it an individual thing more that people go through?
I believe they have the option to access sports psychiatrists, I believe, and sports psychologists. I believe that they are there on hand to help them. I hope so too, because it's such an important thing. You know, we're always listening to podcasts and high performance podcasts, and, you know, the amount of sports stars who say, you know, that they needed that help and guidance to train their brain. You know, they've got the fittest bodies, they're the most trained and focused athletes, but the brain's the most powerful muscle. You know, if you're not in control of that, you're in trouble. So it's to strengthen that and to be prepared and to think the right thoughts going into a high pressure situation like that. I hope that they're all getting it. I hope they're maximizing on it, because it's one of the most important skills that you can have.
Yeah, well, it's a great image of you guys sitting watching the anthem and watching it back and going, that's going to be something that we get to experience. So brilliant to have you with us this morning, Siobhan. Thanks a million.
As always, thanks for having me. Have a good day, guys.
It's Siobhan Ahern giving us her thoughts on the Arsenal game last night. You're obviously an Arsenal supporter. Are you feeling comfortable, confident that they're going to go on and win this thing now? Or is this just a bit where you have your hopes dashed again, Kathleen?
I don't know. Emma Byrne has been saying since like the start of the season that Arsenal are going to win the Champions League. Ooh. And I have laughed at her many the time when she has said this.
She seems to know the game.
She does know the game, but I just... They've burned me so many times before, and especially after the injuries and the kind of patch they went through, where like they had such a good run of form, so many clean sheets, like banging in the goals, and then they took this massive dip and it looked like they weren't going to even make the Champions League places, never mind actually go on to win the Champions League. I think Siobhan is right in what she says. It kind of depends on who they get for the next round. My preference would probably be PSG over Wolfsburg. We've had a lot of battles with Wolfsburg over the years, which we haven't come out on top of. And I think PSG are a little bit more flaky as a side. And I think they're a lot less physical than Wolfsburg. And I think that would probably suit Arsenal a little bit more. So I'm conflicted at the moment in that I think we possibly could do something in the Champions League, but I'm concerned that they're not going to make the top three in the league, and not making Champions League for next year would be really disastrous for Arsenal, I think, at this stage, because there are a lot of good players on the market and they're not going to come to Arsenal unless they know they're going to be playing Champions League football.
Money always helps. Money cures everything.
Does talk. Jonas Eidfeld was referencing the Emirates being like, there's a realistic vision now that this could be the home ground for this team, like 20,000 fans there last night. But when he took over, that probably seemed fanciful as an idea, but now all of a sudden you're like, well, yeah,
why not? Yeah, no, it definitely could. I mean, I think probably more realistic is the, you know, you see like a North London derby or something there and there's like 40,000. It's definitely, like, I've done Champions League nights. I was there when they played Barcelona and there was maybe like 12 to 14,000, I think. And I'm probably of the opinion that unless you're getting like that 30, 40,000 in somewhere like the Emirates,
it gets lost.
It gets a little bit lost. And like it still was cool to see the team there, but I would probably rather them find somewhere that's like a halfway house between Bournemouth, that's like a couple of thousand, and the Emirates, which is like a couple of tens of thousands. I'm like, why can't we have a, you know, a ground that's like 20,000 that you can sell out every weekend, or you can nearly sell out every weekend, and then do the massive stuff at the Emirates? And
it's London. There has to be a stadium that would be suitable. I mean, obviously, you want it to be close enough to where the fan base is.
Well, I mean, like Bournemouth is in the middle of nowhere. It's literally, it's so difficult to get to. So anything could be better than that.
Can I just ask you about the squad? Are we expecting any? Ringers to be coming in at this stage? This is the last squad really where there's an opportunity for somebody who we haven't heard of that they've been working feverishly to get a passport for, who comes in and they get a look at pre-World Cup. Are you expecting any of that, or is the squad basically the squad?
So the only ones that have kind of come out, John Fallon reported back when the team were in Spain that Megan Finnegan, the Everton defender, and Sophie Whitehouse, who's the Lewis goalkeeper, were going to come into the squad for this camp. Those are the only ones I've heard of. Apart from that, there hasn't been any rumblings of other players coming in. I think it's interesting, again, that they're all defensive players, seems to be where Vera Powell's mind is at the moment. I'm not expecting any massive surprises. I'll be interested to see now that the like women's Premier Division is back up and running if there'll be any more inclusions from that. I don't know if there will be at this stage. I think like I wasn't particularly impressed with Abby Larkin in the last camp, but she still is very young. I mean, she's only 17, and I think for me, it seemed like she was brought into that camp to almost give her the experience of being in the national team setting and give her some game time in that and kind of make it a little less daunting for future years. Anya Gorman is obviously one of the big shouts from the league as well. So that would probably be the thing I'd be most interested to see, more so than do they actually fly anyone in that we haven't heard of before. Unless it's some big name and then we're all going crazy tomorrow being like, Katie McCabe who?
Who cares?
29 minutes past 9, Kathleen, good stuff. And as I said, make sure you search for Koi Gig in its own feed. You can also get it in the football feed. OTBIM with Gillette Labs, get the ultimate shave or your money back, Neon Knight edition available now. Thomas Riley says Blacksinius lacks awareness at times and doesn't read the game very well. Ford Williamson and McCabe kept the momentum going. That was from last night's 2-0 victory. Ferguson was on with Terry Venables to cover the 98 World Cup on the BBC, says Shane. I actually don't really remember.
Oh, that was too much to me. Yeah, completely forgot that. Michael pointing out it was Brandon Williams and the laughing gas, not Garnacho. It was Brandon in the car. Garnacho was photographed with a vape, I think, in his house, which was controversial. Adrian pointing out as well, they could invite the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy to the Ferguson Keane dinner as well. So, yeah, doesn't think that's going to happen.
John Claffey says, Noel and Liam are back talking. Noel said it in an interview lately. Did he actually say that, or was he like, they have my number? Mm. And his manager has my number and they should give me a call, which is a real kind of, I mean, I'd like you to do this thing, but I'm not going to do it.
Imagine the reunion, though. Oh, it'll be fantastic. Nostalgic for the 90s kids. I think it could happen. Yeah, and I think Adrian's right. The Ferguson Keane one is a little bit more fanciful.
Spectre Core says, when Oasis did MTV Unplugged, Liam cried off with a sore throat and sat in the balcony heckling Noel getting drunk. It's really unfortunate did they ever do anything else other, like, did they do other sessions which were unplugged? Maybe that was so they did two MTV Unplugs, they did one together in 94, says Colm. This is his specialist subject, by the way, if there's ever a mastermind. It's
oh, is it? Yeah,
oh yeah. Fergus Keogh says Kerr had both Keane's, Duff, Dunn, Cunningham, Caban, Finnan, Given and O'Shea at his disposal.
Yeah.
They were a good team.
You think the clubs those players were at, like, you know, top tier Premier League clubs.
Yeah, they were a good team. And, you know, they also were very experienced at that stage. They had a load of caps. So whoever comes in after Stephen Kenny is going to get a players with 40, 50 caps who have massive amounts of experience. We still have a load of players on between 10 and 18 caps who are the backbone of the team at this stage. And I think that I agree with Gary Breen. There are signs of progress. There's signs of a structure. There's signs of them being well coached. And that's what you want. There's also signs of them having ambition, which I think it's a bit rich for Martin O'Neill to be like, oh, they should have gone for it earlier. It's like a bit like you did against Denmark when you took off all your central midfielders and we got hammered 5-1. Like that one. Or was it 6? I can't even remember.
Yeah. 6, wasn't it?
Well,
five.
Oh, we went out to get interviews. Five, yeah. So we went out to get post-match reaction immediately.
Bettner with the penalty.
Yeah, Bettner. Come on, Martin. You've got Bettner on your CV there.
And the best performance by a player ever at the Diva in Christian Eriksen.
Right. Here's a snippet from last night's Wednesday Night Rugby Grand Slam winner, Grace Davitt and Rory O'Connor join Joe. Back after these.
He had such a fitting finale for Ireland. That is not a fitting finale for Leinster, unfortunately. Proof that sport is cruel.
Yeah, and you know, the majority of players don't get the swan song that they deserve. You know, there's very few that go out. We've seen Sarah Hunter do it the weekend. We've seen Brian O'Driscoll do it. And yeah, you can't get it at any level, I think. To win a Grand Slam at home just before a World Cup, you know, I don't think there'll be much to beat that. Yes, fair enough, he's a lot of caps for Leinster, but yeah, it kind of shows he knew it could be an old injury, you know, that he knew was there. Sometimes we have ligaments holding on by a thread, and you know, once you know it's gone, you're going, no, I'm in trouble here. So obviously we know he's going in for surgery for that, and I suppose all eyes now will be on his recovery. And you know, how will he be going into World Cup? Will he be able to recover well enough? Will it, the fact that he not have game time, will he get back for the autumns? So Leinster's loss is, you know, wrapping him up in cotton wool for a World Cup to get the final swan song. So you know, there has to be a change over at some point. So although it's not the way he would have liked it, why not let these other guys, you know, the likes of Harry Byrne, get an opportunity, you know, get more game time for Leinster, get to the big games and not just say, right, you've got us through to URC, you've got us to the quarterfinals, now Johnny's back in. So why not let them get a bit of reward for the work that they are putting in behind the scenes? Because, you know, he isn't going to be there next year. And, you know, for Ireland, I suppose that the goal is we want them for the World Cup.
Yeah, more on that rugby a little bit later on the week. Of course, it is 8:34. Stewie Byrne is with us. Stuart, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, Jared. How are you? Morning, Shane.
Morning, Stewie.
We're entering a really interesting phase of the league campaign at the League of Ireland, where if Rovers just lose a few more games, then we're guaranteed a title race. I think this is actually, we've been talking about this, I'd say, for 15 years, where there's always been one team who, you know, at the start of the year is going to win the league, and it's not great for the sense of competition.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
this year, Rovers' little blip at the start has come at exactly the right time to keep everybody engaged. From, I suppose, Balls was thinking, we could just take a bit of a run here together, get a bit of a lead up.
I'd say there's a couple of teams thinking that they can might have a little shot at it, all right, yeah. Certainly there's interest, there's no doubt about it. And the whole four in the row talk and, you know, maybe that's unsettled them a little bit, I don't know. But, like, to win two leagues in a row is a difficult task. Winning one league is a difficult task. I always felt it's harder to retain it. It is. It's a hard task to do. That's why not many clubs have really done it, you know. But to win four is a very, very extremely difficult task, as I'm sure Rovers are finding out. However, you know, when you look at where we were at this time last year, there isn't too much of a difference really in terms of points, and Rovers comfortably clawed that back. But I would say, I do feel there's definitely a level of competition in the league this year that hasn't been there for a while. I think it's been building for a while, and that's, you know, just to take your point, I've been a bit critical of the gaps, I suppose. It's kind of been either a Rovers or a Dundalk or a Cork, you know, there's been one or two together, and then the big gap between the rest, and then there's always been a couple of clubs that would come out of nowhere that would, you know, sort of, Bowes did it a couple of years ago, and sort of fell away again. Wasn't their time. However, you might argue it could be their time this year. That, you know, a lot of clubs have gone full time now, with the exception maybe of one or two. Things are in good shape for them, all right.
That's the difference that it feels to me as an outsider watching on. It feels like there's been sustainable growth from a bunch of teams. Bowes and Shells are an example of it, where they haven't pushed all their chips into the table, chips that maybe they didn't even own in some cases in the past. Yeah. They've like, okay, well, what can we do this season to build for next season, and what can we do to build on that? That's one aspect. And the other aspect of it, it doesn't feel as if as many of the better players have been picked off by League 1 and League 2 teams. That's just an instinct to have. I haven't seen the numbers on that, but it feels like the teams are slightly more settled than they have been in previous years.
That, I felt that this year, and one of the points I made this year was actually probably a little bit settled in terms of the managers. I mean, remember last year we had a managerial merry-go-round, like, you know, and it didn't look good from the outside looking in, you know, with Steve O'Donnell leaving Pats, you went to Dundalk, and then Tim went into to Pats, and then there was just seemed to be, Rory was only kind of new in at the Derry thing, but like it just felt like there was an unsettlement last year. However, this year, I think most of the clubs were able to do their business in good time. They've hit pre-season, they've hit the start of the league campaign in good shape. Rovers not getting off to a good start, I think has given impetus to the rest, you know, which is what should happen. I do think they'll come good. But I don't know how you feel about this. I actually think there's a general levelling, you know, not just here and in other leagues around the world. I think the big boys, the gaps aren't as big as they used to be. I don't know why. It's almost like the lesser teams are saying, you know what, these aren't great shakes, or they don't have those resources to go any further. They're kind of starting to come back to each other. That's how I feel anyway, at least.
Obviously they've got far superior players, but it feels like the tactical understanding of the game has increased to such a level that you can thwart the best teams, and it's not just about trying to stop them scoring.
Yeah.
You all, like, everybody has access to, you watch this video about how you go inside.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally agree. I've been making that point in myself for a while. Like, I totally get it. Everyone's doing the same physical conditioning stuff. Everyone's reading the same tactical books. They're all doing the same coaching courses. So the access to resources, it's all the same. Where, so what's going to make the difference?
One last point is, I think that actually the way the football is the teams are trying to score in a way that in the 80s and the 90s, if you had just a really good defence, you were guaranteed to be competitive in the league. Whereas now, you need to be able to score in games. You can't draw your way to a league title the way you could have do in Serie A in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like,
well, obviously, as soon as three points for a win came in, I think that changed the game as well. Like, you know, but the point of trying to score your way, I think
there's a more creative aspect that coaches are actually, you know, that it feels a little bit like bad teams can beat good teams, as opposed to bad teams can only dream of drawing with good teams.
Yeah, I think what also may have happened is the era of parking the bus, so to speak. That's just to kind of put it. I think that's evolving again now. Whereas you can't do that forever either. Like, you know, and to take your point, to pick up on your point.
The Shell style is interesting. Like, I think it's, I was just looking at the table there. They've scored four goals. They've conceded three in six games. Yeah. 1-2, drawn 2, lost 2. Like, it's middle of the road stuff, but it's quite defensive. Some people saying it's difficult to watch at times, but it gets results. So yeah. Duffer maybe deserves a little bit of credit for it as well.
I think doesn't, like, it, I mean, just even to kind of take for Damien's point of view, he's a young manager. He's only come in, like, you know, and the last thing he wants to do is kind of the last one anyone wants to do is be gung ho and, you know, just throw caution to the wind, that kind of stuff. But there is an element of that, although you do like to see that as well. Like, you know, you don't want to see teams being overly cautious, but I think it's a fine balancing act. You have to work with what you have available in terms of your budget. I think the budget is fantastic there. You made the analogy of Shelburne and Bowes there, Ger. I think Bowes certainly have at least 3 or 4 years of a head start on Shells. Like, and that shows, and that's obviously, Shells are kind of saying, well, look, if we just maintain where we are at the moment, that's where we're going to get to, and hopefully investment follows. But from Damien's point of view, I think to be fair to him, I think where maybe the team might lack a little bit of, I don't know, what do you want to say, a bit of flair or a bit of je ne sais quoi, I think he makes up for it. Mm. Like, you know, so it kind of does a balance there in the squad, where he's Mourinho used to do a brilliant thing with Chelsea. He used to always take the attention off the players.
Yeah.
You know, he had this brilliant tactic. Now, it we all fell for it in the end, but I think we'd all agree that in the early years, it was gold, because we were just attracted on him and the players just got on with the job. I'm not saying he's doing the same again, but considering he played under him, he knows the man, I would imagine he's certainly taken snippets of his management style.
I also feel a little bit like, if you are trying to build something from a team who has come up the way Shelburne have, that you need to make sure that your defence is really good and really solid, and that, like, it's a long-term project. You can't go gung-ho to try and, you know, go on a surge without it actually being built on solid foundations. It feels a little bit like, from him, that he's thinking in those terms, as opposed to, you know, trying to go toe-to-toe week in, week out, Ozzy Ardile style.
There is another thing, and it's a kind of a dynamic that crept in. I would like to I hope it's kind of crept in there over kind of before COVID, a little bit after COVID. This kind of this fear of going down. This kind of you just have to stay up. And if you would talk to anybody at the start of any league campaign, I would say one team wanted to win the league. Two or three wanted to get Europe, and the rest just wanted to stay up. And I think that's affected the psychology of some of the teams. And I, you know, I'd like to think that maybe that's starting to drift away a little bit, because it's not just it's not good enough to kind of just want to stay up. I don't think so. It is.
That's fascinating. So teams just accepting their level, essentially.
Yeah, and you know what happens? It filters through the club into the supporters, and you'd be talking to the supporters and saying, "I just want to stay up." You're kind of going, "Oh my lord, where's your ambition gone?" Like, you know,
yeah, but this is supposed to be joyful.
Listen to yourself.
This is not mass. You know,
like, Leicester won the Premier League in 2016, and so on. So, like, I do think maybe I'd like to hope that that's kind of gone a little bit as well, because I don't see huge differences in six clubs in this league, and
Derry,
any one of them. Yeah,
Dundalk. Who's after that? Are you counting Sligo and Shells, or do you have Cork City and obviously Rovers?
Yeah, you got Rovers. I think Dundalk, you got Pats should be competitive. There's no doubt Pats should be competitive. They've got a little bad start, but there's no reason why they can't turn that around as well. You got Derry. I was up in Derry, Sligo the other night. I've got to say, Sligo have something about them this year, a resilience that I haven't seen in a Sligo team for a long, long time. I think they're going to be difficult to beat. And Derry were a little bit, weren't at the races, to be quite honest with you. That was an opportunity for them to kind of go, I think it might have been 11 points clear, and didn't take it. They ended up just getting a good draw out of it. So it's, I just think the difficulty is doing it week in, week out, Jared. It's a mentality thing, you know. That Rovers have that mentality. They know what it takes. Derry certainly tasted it a little bit last year and will no doubt have learned from it. But I just feel there's others that are in there that can have a go. And it's wide open at the moment. I'm not coming away. I don't know any one team really that has overly impressed me so far this season.
The fixtures this weekend, for everybody wondering, it's Cork City versus Drogheda, Cork at home, Dundalk at home to Shamrock Rovers, Shelburne at home to Derry City, St Pat's at home to UCD, and then the following day it's Sligo Rovers at home to Bowes. All these games are actually pretty good and meaningful in
competitive, yeah,
their own way.
Yeah.
So Dundalk and Rovers, Dundalk looked like quite slow to get into the season and then absolutely exploded into it, and they've been a bit up and down, but they're building something, and again hope that it's more sustainable than some of the stuff that's happened in the past.
I think Stevie's probably of all the clubs, he's probably gone outside of Ireland looking to bring players in, and that can be a difficulty because you're trying to settle players into a different environment. You know, you got the town of Dundalk where you can't fart without somebody knowing about it. However, what I would say, it's a town that, like, if you know, when they get behind you, they get behind you. You know, and that's the kind of, it's very, very similar to in Cork as well, isn't it? I mean, you probably say that, and there's an analogy there with most of the towns around Dublin, around Ireland. Dublin is a little bit different because of the way the dynamic works there. But Stevie certainly has brought in players from outside, and it can be a little bit harder to bed them in. They got a wonderful start last year. Don't forget, they were top of the table. They were the ones that really capitalised on the fact that Derry hit a bit of a wall last year in around that May-June period in around Europe, and all of a sudden Dundalk found themselves top of the table, and then of course they couldn't maintain that either, like, you know.
Colin's in my ear saying Cork is not a town.
A city, is it?
City boy.
Yeah, what's categorised as a city? Cathedral, is it?
Something like that, yeah. Technically you need two cathedrals, or you need a cathedral.
He's not in his head there frantically, look at him.
Somehow Kilkenny gets in. Really not sure about that, but anyway.
Good town, Cork.
So did Dundalk, so he's swearing in my ears now, which I'm not allowed to do on air. Did Dundalk turn a corner then after getting beaten by Bowes when they hammered St Pat's? Is that what we should expect them to just maintain that level? Like, the point about betting in players, is that period over now and we should just expect them to be at their level, and so therefore
it should be. I always found that you need at least 8-9 games before you hit your mark, and that's all round, you know, the balance of the team is right, even your own personal fitness, you know, and you're kind of hitting games kind of full pelt, you know. And certainly I would have thought that Dundalk would have ironed out those cracks now, and I would expect them to be competitive now.
Obviously Shamrock Rovers will not be scared of anything given the level of experience they have and the talent they have and the backroom team that they have, but if you're Dundalk at home against Rovers and if you beat them, you're opening up a significant gap and you're really sending them into crisis. Do you go to win the game at all costs, or are you like, this is a home league game against Shamrock Rovers who we consider to be one of our rivals for the title? If we get a draw in this game and a draw against them, then we'll stand up over the course of the rest of the season on our results against everybody else. How do you approach it as a management team, and what message are you giving to the players? Because they could be two different things, obviously.
Yeah,
but
well, the era of, this is why I think there might be a bit of a leveler in terms of the big boys and small boys. That era of going into games with fear against the bigger teams, I don't think it's there as much as it used to be. So I'd imagine Dundalk would be looking at the Rovers results so far, although they've been playing well, and I think they'd be looking at it. I mean, you have to use what's at your disposal to beat who you're playing on any Friday, okay? So you've got to look at Rovers. They're under big pressure. They're not playing well. You know, there's four in a row talk. And that has to be part of the rhetoric. That has to be, you know, that has to be part of the motivation to Dundalk. Plus, you know, because they're, you know, if you, like what you say, if we knock these out of a league title race, then there's a possibility of us slotting in there. That has to be part of the talk.
There's 6 points clear of them at the moment. If you were to go 9 points clear, yeah. Like, no, it's really, really early. It's ridiculous to be talking about, like, Rovers being out of the title race if they lose this game. It's totally ridiculous. But a 9 point lead is a 9 point lead.
Yeah, it's huge.
You know?
Yeah, it is. It's huge.
I know we're kind of half joking about the Cork stuff there, but like, it strikes me, the conversation, and it's a big conversation, granted, but the idea of the league could go from strength to strength with more teams from outside Dublin. Like, you look at that Premier Division table, you've got the five teams from Dublin, you've got Dundalk and Drogheda, which are stone's throw, albeit Louth is not Dublin, and then you've Cork, Derry, Sligo. Like, the conversation often happens around, you know, if there are teams from Tip or Mayo or Monaghan, places, counties that have no, or regions that have no League of Ireland team, that maybe the league could go from strength to strength. I don't know if that's something that you...
I would love it, yeah. I would love it. But you have to be competitive. You have to be competitive.
It's a long-term thing as well, obviously.
Yeah, there has to be commitment as well. You know, I don't... To even understand the level of work that goes into running a football club is, you know, it's only something that I'm kind of even experiencing since I sort of moved away from playing. Like, it's very, extremely difficult. It's made even more difficult because we work in an environment in this country. It's not easy to get things done. You know what I mean? You put your hand out, it gets slapped, to be quite honest. And then, you know, the other sports have certainly seem to have an awful lot easier. So there needs to be. I do think the game here needs to come together. I know clubs can be their own individual entities, and they have to go their own individual paths because they have different objectives or whatever the case may be. But there has to be a collectiveness when it comes to trying to lobby government or lobby stakeholders in order to improve the game. That's something we haven't been good at in the past. I think we are definitely getting better at that. But we've been, you know, this country has been doing extremely well for the last, you know, we talked about the Celtic Tiger back in the 90s. I mean, there's no doubt we've been going through a second Celtic Tiger, and no one's been talking about it. And it would be an awful shame if the game didn't progress in some shape or form during this period, you know, and especially even the post COVID period, you want to put a name on it, like, you know, there's this huge grow for live events, for, you know, and the football has definitely benefited from that, I would have thought.
News that Virgin are going to show the Rovers Bowls game, is it next week?
Friday week, yeah.
This is big.
It's brilliant. I came out nowhere. I didn't know it. I didn't know this was in the pipeline. I think it's fantastic. I really do. It's been a grow of people for a while that we don't show all the games week in, week out.
You can't build familiarity with the teams, with the plot lines, and with the issues, and with the managers or the star players, or with the fan bases. Yeah. You can't see them,
and it's a habitual thing. Like, you know, we the league starts and we show four or five games, and then we drop off, and then we show four. And it's, you know, it's very difficult to get consistency going. Would be fantastic if we could show a game on live television once a week. I think that's probably where we're trying to get. Obviously, I work for I cover the games for RTE. I know how difficult it is to kind of get that schedulized. It's extremely difficult, and it's part of the business that maybe not everyone fully understands. The numbers don't tend to be very good either. So for all the want for people to see live games on a Friday, you'd be quite surprised sometimes that people maybe just don't watch it. However, it goes back to your point. If that familiarity is there, if you know there's going to be a game on every week, I do think people will watch.
Yeah, it's the if you build it, they'll come. But you have to be there for a long period of time to see the bits that that happen over the course of the season. The Derry City story, obviously, they're away at Shells this week. They're the ones who obviously have had the massive ownership come in with all the money, and there's a lot of hype about it. But again, instead of like just going smash bang last season, it seems like they've slowly built, and they've got a good young progressive manager who is taking his time with this.
Yeah, I think he's signed really well, Rory. What he's done is he's brought back top players that are familiar with the club, with the, I don't know, I always feel Derry is, has a uniqueness in its history, in the city itself, that, you know, the history of the city. It's something that you just can't get away from. And I think Rory, I think he really gets that, you know, and bringing the likes of Patrick McElhenney back and Duffy, these are all people, very familiar, top players, you know, top professionals, which is probably more important, because you need players, you know, the day in and the day out. That's it's what you do Monday to Thursday is what it happens on a Friday.
Yeah.
And then I think what he's brought in unknowns, youths, and he's developed the squad extremely well.
No, exciting times. Shoey, good stuff. Thanks a million.
Thanks, guys.
Shoey. If anybody wants to get a colouring book, where should they get one?
Game We Love.
8:53, Colm Lanny's here. Colm, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, lads. How's it going?
Very good. What's going on?
Well, you're talking about the League of Ireland there, Women's Premier Division last night. Piemont had an unbeaten start to the season, but they lost to Shelburne last night. Megan Smith-Lynch scoring twice there. Four shells at PLR Park. They won by 4-1. Shamrock Rovers continued their good start. 2-1 win over Wexford Youths. Galway United beat Athlone Town by the same scoreline. In the other games last night, Bowles had a 3-0 win over DLR Waves. Treaty United and Cork City played out a 1-1 draw. Of course, we're awaiting news on Katie McCabe and her injury and the extent of it. She's set to have a scan today, having picked up that foot injury in Arsenal's 2-0 win over Bayern in the Champions League last night. And of course, the Ireland manager Vera Powell due to name her squad for those friendlies against the United States next month. That squad due to be released tomorrow. Arsenal through to the semi-finals, 2-1 winners in aggregate. Barcelona also through, 6-1 aggregate victory for them over Roma. Tonight, Chelsea have a 1-0 lead heading into their second leg against Lyon, and Wolfsburg have a 1-0 advantage heading into their second leg at home to Paris Saint-Germain. That's in the Women's Champions League this evening. A bit of a shock in the Ulster Under-20 Football Championship last night. Down beat the reigning Ulster and All-Ireland champions Tyrone by 2-9 to 1-8 to knock them out. Down set to play Monaghan now in the semi-finals. They were 1-11 to 13 points winners over Cavan. Donegal beat Antrim on penalties, and they're set to play Derry after Derry beat Fermanagh by 3-12 to 8 points. In the Munster Under-20 Hurling, Clare and Limerick played out a 1-19 apiece draw. Cork picked up their first win with a 1-17 to 1-13 victory over Waterford. In golf, the week before the Masters, the Valero Texas Open is on this week. Padraig Harrington and David Carey in the field there from an Irish point of view, and Leona Maguire and Stephanie Meadow both in action at the LA Open on the LPGA Tour, and there's racing today at both Nace and Limerick.
All right, Colm, good stuff. Thanks a million for that. It is 8:55. Some highlights on the OTB Podcast Network for you today. Wednesday Night Rugby, Football Daily, and John Duggan with Jason Smith. You can follow Off the Ball across social and subscribe to the OTB Podcast Network. During the ad break, you will hear a clip from our interview with Jason Smith, permanent TSB ambassador and Paralympic icon. It's all with thanks to Permanent TSB, proud title sponsor of the Irish Olympic team and Irish Paralympic team. We're back after this with Conor Moores. You had to be there.
So unexpected.
It's one of those you had to be there moments.
You had to be there.
It subsequently genuinely did change everything about my life.
You had to be there.
Right, I'm looking forward to this. Conor Moore's list of you had to be there is pretty, pretty, pretty good, Conor.
Yeah, it deviates a lot. There's a few different sports in it anyway. Mm.
Was it difficult for you to put together?
Not really. There was different things. I was going to throw a Formula One thing, but I was like, is that like a really, the performance-wise, it wasn't something that you're like, whoa. It was the whole event that was wow. So I suppose this was like you had to be there.
Yeah.
Performances kind of thing. So yeah.
We're not talking about your performances. We're talking about other
things. No. I that would have been hard.
Yeah.
I can tell you about a few times I've burnt already. Bombed.
Have you bombed?
I bombed, yeah, about twice.
What's bombed? What's the double bombed?
Where you're not getting like a laugh. I remember going to Kerry years ago and I did a thing, the Gaeltacht did a gig, and up until that point I did about 10 gigs where they were just kind of GA gigs, so you'd walk in and just go, oh, shin, whatever, and slag them off and everybody laughs, and it was so easy, and I was thinking, oh, this is just a doddle, like, you know. And so you go then, and this is a bit more of a corporate gig, and I get up there and it's in the INEC and there's a big gap between me and all the people, so you can't even see the mannerisms or anything, and can't remember who was interviewing me, but I did it anyway, and it was just getting no laughs, and it had never happened to me before, and it was like I was maybe a couple of months into it, and Brawley was after telling everybody, because we were at his table, so wait until you see Conor going up. He says he's absolutely wonderful, this man is, he's a marvel, so he is, he's a genius, watch this. And I get up there and I absolutely, like,
no pressure,
stink the place out of it. And at the end, and then whoever was interviewing me says, he goes, at the end of it, I'll ask you how this all came about, because this has been very quick and you've just gone, you know, whatever. And I says, yeah. So at the end, I finished up and literally crickets, you know.
Oh, geez.
And then the guy goes, so Connor, tell us how you started all this. Like, and I was holding the microphone. I won't curse, but pretty much I turn. He goes, tell us how you started all this. And I forgot to take the mic down off my mouth. And I looked at him and I put my hand on his shoulder. He goes, I know that. I said, like, and I got the biggest laugh.
Oh, no.
Off the stage. Off stage left. I remember going up to the hotel room and I was like, I can't go down there and face him. Broly rings me up. He's like, come down. He goes, oh, yeah. Blah, blah. And in fairness, he was dead right. Went down. I had a great laugh for the rest of the night. Like, but I remember that was the first. I was like, ooh.
You kind of need to go through that though, right?
Oh, like, 110%. You learn so much more from those gigs than you do doing any other. Because I remember talking to Barry Murphy years ago. I met him for a coffee and it's like, you have to know the room. Mm. Like, and I'm very much like that. So if I have to know everyone who's in the room, if they're golf people or if they're whatever people, and you tailor the gig to them. Because if you don't, like, you'll burn a lot more often. So.
You run the risk. Yeah, fair enough. All right, let's get into this list because it's really good. Desi Dolan in 2003, it's Westmead versus Meath. This is the draw.
2:13 apiece.
Yeah, I had to stick this one in.
It's only a quarter final, Leinster quarter final as well.
So hang on, is this the miss?
Did you not know?
I wasn't sure. I thought you were going to pick it the year they win.
No, as in that was more of a team performance, but I was kind of going for individual displays here. And I started following Westmead, I'd say 2001. And literally, it was the same story every year. You were playing Meath. I remember the quarterfinal of the Leinster 2001. And the narrative was always the same. We're leading. We're about 5 points up. There's about 20 minutes to go. High ball is kicked in. Miles or Nestor, one of these boys, drives the ball down the field. And Graham Gehrig comes in, punches it into the net. Or else it breaks to Ollie Murphy and he slips it in. This happened 2001 and we had a great run in the qualifiers. And 2003 then. The reason I remember this game so well is we were sitting in the Hogan stand. And there was this old man behind us and he was talking to my dad and he was having this con. He was, I've been following Westmead now for about since 1958 and I've never seen us beat Mead. And we were going, and we were losing a half time, I remember. But Desi was having probably one of the greatest games, and I've seen him playing club matches and stuff, but at this level, maybe one of the best games I've ever seen him play. It was, he couldn't do anything wrong. The ball, every ball just fell to him. Kind of, you know, one of those days everything goes right for you and stuff. And I remember, like, even there was a high ball in and the goalkeeper went to catch it or something. I can't remember if he caught it up here or down there or whatever, but it bounced back into Desi's chest pretty much. And I think he punched it into the net, if I remember. And then he gets a free out in the sideline. And it's like 14 yards out. And it was one of the best frees I've ever seen. And I think he mightn't have even went to the 14-yard line with it, which you're supposed to, like. I think he kicked it from inside it. And everybody's like, this is unbelievable. We're a point up or whatever. Or sorry, it's a draw game. And I can't remember who committed the free. Was it a pick-up off the ground? I can't remember too much. But it happened. And then the Mead boys remonstrated with the referee. So it wasn't now a 30-yard free. It was a 21-yard free. Mm. And the old man grabbed my father and he said it again. He says, 19, and he named the year, what it was, 48 or 58 or something. I've been following Westmead and we haven't done it, and blah, blah, blah. And Desi was after having the most amazing game I've ever seen of anyone. And then he gets the ball outside, now 21 yards out, and he misses the free. He's going to love that I brought this up. I love Desi, but I just had to. It was like, growing up like in Westmead, everyone, when you're playing football, especially if you're a forward, Desi's your hero. Like, and it just was one of the most amazing. It's a folklore game, like, because he missed it. And I remember a lot of people were saying, oh no, that went over the bar. But you could see from Desi's body language, he knew it didn't go over the bar or whatever. So, like, it went wide, but, like, it was possibly the greatest miss in the history of Westmead GAA. Because, well, things then, they went for a change that year, obviously. And Luke Dempsey was after doing some amazing stuff for Westmead. And it was probably unfair, but we ended up getting Paddy. We ended up winning Leinster. Would that have happened without Paddy?
The rest is history.
So it was a bittersweet moment. It was an amazing performance, but I had to throw that in there. Desi loved that one.
Maybe you would have won it that year if you'd just kicked that one.
No. I definitely think we would have lost in the semi-finals. I genuinely believe we wouldn't have won it. I think, not that, like, obviously, like, you can't say you don't know, but I think that Paddy brought something like a winner's mentality to it, and I just made people believe.
I'm just googling here. So Pete McGavin Comiskey in 2003, Luke Dempsey stepped down as manager of Westmeath after the County Football Board delegates voted to re-interview for the position. So I suspect that they knew that Paddy was available. Dempsey had 9 years of inter-county involvement, three as senior manager, leading Westmeath to minor and under 21 All-Ireland titles. So like, he's like, this is my natural progression, and we've got there, and then Paddy comes in.
And he was only given 3 years as well. Like, he definitely deserved. And after, like, obviously, you know, if the ball was kicked over the bar, he was keeping his job. All he had to do, really, he didn't have to win the Leinster. He just had to beat Meath.
Yeah.
That was the big thing. Like, because 2001, we had the quarterfinal of the Leinster and then the quarterfinal of the All-Ireland. And the exact same thing happened where we were well ahead. And Westmeath, to be fair, as much as people say, oh, we were minnows when we won it in 2004, like, we had an unbelievable team.
Well, obviously, I didn't realise backbone by Minor and All-Ireland under 21 like, glory.
Our half-back line was Michael Ennis, Ger Heaven, Damien Healy, who were three players that could get in any half-back line in Ireland at that point. You had Rory O'Connell at midfield.
John Keane was in that team as well.
One of probably, I think, was it Brogan or one of them that said he was like
toughest opponent or something?
Yeah. He just... And John wasn't like the most amazing fellow with a football in his hand or whatever, and he'd admit that himself, but like, my God, like, he didn't need to be. He was just so incredibly fast and tenacious, and like, when he'd tackle you, it was just, I don't know, it was like piranhas eating you or something. Like, he was just all over you.
Fair play to Desi for making the TV ad for Vodafone a couple of years later. Or was it
Aircel? He made a few quid off it. I remember my father watching that and he goes, that for making money off us. Or off our misery. I was full sure I was going to get it. That was the ad. I was full sure. It was probably out to have me one of my best games. But he really did, like, and in fairness, like, he's definitely our greatest player, like, in my opinion. Like,
it's a real sliding doors moment, though, because as you say, like, Luke Dempsey definitely gets to keep the gig. Right, so that's the first one. It's a bit of a Debbie Downer. Most people,
but we won the Leinster. I think it was like bittersweet. I think it all. You wouldn't write that script now in Hollywood.
No, and in fairness, the fact that they do come back to win the Leinster means that everybody gets some kind of
everybody but Luke wins.
I know,
but it's also watching your county. I think is the most nervous you could possibly be. You're probably the same for Kildare in '98, but like, anytime I couldn't cover a Monaghan match in a work capacity because I'd be too nervous. Yeah, so I think when you're watching your home county, you're just like, nah, that can't.
You're emotionally invested in a game like that. You're not actually like watch it. Yeah, you're giving out everyone that makes a mistake. You're giving out. It's hard to like
process
the objective.
Right. So Tiger Woods at the Masters in 2019. This isn't bad, right? This is Woods back from the death, really, to win in 2019 is kind of one of the all-time great sporting feats. You were there.
Yeah, it was my first time at the Masters, and I remember when I got there on I think it was the Monday evening, and
You working or were you hanging out?
I was actually I had a gig on the Wednesday night for the Golf Channel, but it was a gig like that you do, like my golf gig is kind of, if you told me to do the golf gig right now, I could do it. Like, it wasn't that I had to like prepare, you know, I have all the lines in my head. So.
You're not supposed to say stuff like this, Connor. It's like, oh, it's
so much work goes into it.
Slave over every line and every joke for weeks and weeks.
But I was doing a gig, it was just by a pool house or something, so I had that gig on the Wednesday night, so I was really there watching it. I had a Berkman's pass.
What's that?
A Berkman's pass is where, just off the fifth, there is this, it's like another clubhouse, and it's a pass that you get, and it's all just caviar and prawns and...
Apart from that, you were raised in Westmeath, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I know, yeah, it was, I don't know how I got it, like, well, I got it through the Golf Channel, they gave it to me or whatever. But I was there and it was the most, I'd built it up in my head so much, and I was hoping I didn't build it up too much that I was going to be a bit disappointed. And I actually even, like, I remember walking in the gate and I had this kind of cynical thought in my head going, bet you I won't be blown away by this place like everybody else is. And as I came around the corner and I looked over at the range, I saw all the players at the range and all the caddies in boiler suits. And I was like, what year is it?
Yeah.
You know, it was like that. I was like,
stepping back in time.
If I could have taken, because you don't have phones or anything there, if you could have taken a photograph, it is the most beautiful, magical place. And the fact that there's no phones just adds so much to the mystique and just everything about the place. But going in there, like, just didn't think. Tiger was after, I was only after doing the ad with him with Bridgestone.
Yeah.
And we were having a bit of a slag about like him winning majors, and he'd won the tour championship, and he went well at Carnoustie. He could have won at Carnoustie. He was close. PGA championship as well. Brooks, I think he was second or third, or he's top five anyway. And you kind of thought, yeah, maybe he could do it, like, and he started off well. Now, I have to caveat, I was not there on the Sunday. I was there Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And on the Saturday, like, he had a pretty good round. I remember on six, I was there on six, he birdied six, seven, eight. I seen the sixth. I think he birdied, was it 13 and 15? And it was just, I felt like you were watching Tiger, the old Tiger. Because I'd seen him in a couple of competitions and the crowds follow him. But like most of the time I'd seen him, like I remember seeing him at the Players the year before in another competition. He didn't feature, he missed the cut, I think, and stuff. So I was kind of thinking to myself, like, you haven't seen Tiger. Like, you've seen like the kind of ceremonial guy that goes around and plays golf and stuff.
He's
like,
he's going
to
be teeing off at the Masters first. Yeah. And that's it.
Like, that's the only time I ever seen him. And then I seen him, was he wearing like purple or something that day on the Saturday? And he had those turtlenecks he was wearing,
yeah,
which, you know, brought back memories of 97. But he just played some unbelievable golf that day. Like, he amazing control of the ball. And did he have a 5 or 6 under, something like that? And when you're following Tiger, obviously, it's not easy to follow Tiger. So you have to go a couple of holes ahead of him. So, like, you know, I seen the sixth. But then, you know, you go to 9 then after, or maybe 10 even. Just so you're there, so you'll stand behind the tee box. It'll still be packed because they'll be waiting for him.
Yeah.
So you kind of just have to like keep moving forward. So I got to see him birdie, I think it was the 13th, six, where he came down the hill. That wasn't an easy tee shot, but it was just incredible. And a lot of people say to me, do you regret that you left on the Saturday night? And I'd no regrets. Because you wouldn't, and especially on Sunday, even trying to get close to the 18th green, I don't think you would have been from
possible.
A distance.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have seen it. And especially me being 5'5" and a half, well, 5'6" sometimes.
The half.
Rounded up, sure. Yeah, rounded up.
But Con Hoolan famously said that he went to Italy for the World Cup in 1990 and missed the World Cup because it was happening here. In a way, you feel a little bit like that sometimes at golf tournaments where, so if you, are you just looking at the leaderboards or the big scoreboard and seeing birdie between 6 and 8?
Yeah, that's what's magical as well about Augusta is that they change the scoreboards, I think, every 3 holes. Mm. So I remember sitting on...
I didn't know that.
On the 13th, yeah. It's every couple of holes they'll change the
scoreboards.
So it's
not every hole. You don't...
No.
Waiting for some big change, you don't know,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, well, from what I can remember anyway, because it doesn't change for a couple of holes and then they'll flip it over. So when the guys are coming around, they're looking up at the scoreboard. But you could be a hole or two behind, yeah. So you don't actually know if someone's...
Wow. That's good drama.
And then... I remember sitting on the 13th and they have a grandstand on the 13th. So the tee box is back here. So you get to see 12 or whatever. But then the scoreboard is over here. And I remember the scoreboard changing like on Tiger. Was it the 10th or something? Whatever he birdied. And the place just goes nuts. And that's what they talk about, the Tiger roar. Like, you know, it's his roar. You know, like, it wasn't McIlroy that birdied a hole or something. Now, unless they're coming down the stretch and it's the last 2 or 3 holes and it's hugely significant. But over the course of the whole 4 days, like when Tiger
did anything,
drops a birdie or even saves a good par, the decibel level of the roar is just, it is something to experience. And I'm glad I seen him. I don't know what, is he the ceremonial golfer now?
Potentially, yeah.
I can't see how you could, you know, show up at a tournament and, a bit like they're talking about the LIV guys, however bad they have it. And Tiger, like, obviously wants to win majors, but, like, you have to put in the reps. You have to get the rounds in. And he obviously can't. Because if he could, he would.
But it's beautiful because we've joked before, and I've spoken about the image of Michael Jordan breaking the record in the NBA recently, and everybody has the phone out. Like, literally.
LeBron.
Yeah. And literally, I think it was maybe Phil Knight was the only person in the photograph that was watching with his eyes.
Seen that,
but
yeah.
You always see that with Tiger as well, teeing off, that it's... Everybody has the phone. Nobody is watching with their actual eyes. And at the Masters, that must have been quite a beautiful thing to nearly just take it in and appreciate it.
It's lovely. And you're going around. Even one of my mates was there and he came in and the Berkman's Pass, actually, what they have out the back of it is they have 3 greens and they've modelled them on 3 of the greens. So they're miniature greens, but they're the exact same. They're scaled down.
Yeah.
So I think it could be like...
Are there putters and stuff?
7,
you
11,
over?
14. You've caddies, you've putters,
oh,
whatever
wow.
putter you want. And then you go over. And I mean, when you think you've played golf on a green, and then they tell you, okay, so the hole's over there, and the caddy's standing here, and he's like, you want to hit this mark here? And you're like, what? And then you hit it, and sure, it goes a mile over this way. He's like, yeah, but you hit it too hard. And I'm like, All right. And then you tap this ball and it's like if I roll the golf ball down the table here, it just keeps going and going and going. And you're thinking like the
snooker table stuff.
Oh, and they have the stint the exact same as
every day
out there.
Wow.
Yeah, of whatever day that is and stuff. So they've modelled it exactly so you get to kind of experience that. But it is such a surreal experience. And I do say to anybody, like, and even though, like, forget the Berkman's thing or just been out there on the course, and everybody says the same thing, like, so I'm not saying anything new, but you don't appreciate how undulating it is. Like, you walk out and the first just goes like this. It's like a hit, it goes down and it comes up.
Yeah.
And the greens, a guy could be standing at the bottom of the green, and definitely me anyway, but like the top of the green could be over his head, the far side.
Yeah.
Like, that's how.
Is it like a little, it's like its own little paradise? Because I remember passing through when I was on the J1 in South Carolina, I remember passing through Augusta in a bus, in a Greyhound bus, and like the town isn't that appealing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's just the actual course that has its own little mystique.
Yeah, I didn't really frequent the town all that much. Like, there was so much going on. Like, I was at a house just outside it, but yeah, it's like that. It's just kind of there off on its own or whatever. But it was funny, actually. Freddie Couples had texted me on the practice round, and he was like, "Was that you that shouted there at Tiger?" Because someone went, "Oh man, that was tough." And then Tiger looks at Freddie, and then Freddie's like, "Is that Connor or whatever?" So Freddie texts me and goes, "Are you like following us, saying it was tough?" So it wasn't me, like, it wasn't me at all. But when he came off on the 9th, I remember Freddie grabbed me or whatever, and he brought me over to the clubhouse area, and I was in like the car park and stuff. And I remember this guy in a green jacket just touched me on the shoulder, and I was kind of going, "Do I have a passport here or whatever?" Like, and I literally thought I was getting thrown out, and I mean, like, it was like getting caught by the police or something. My heart rate was like, I was like, and the guy was like, "Love your stuff." It was an Irish fella that was a member, whatever.
Brilliant.
But it is just a great place. I think if you're in any way into golf or even into sports, like, it's a bucket list item.
Yeah,
like, you know, to take it off. See it. Yeah, it really is.
That bit about getting tapped on the shoulder, right? When did the imposter syndrome go away?
It doesn't really, because the guys with the green jackets, because the guys will walk around with their green jackets, obviously, and they, like, you know, obviously you see some celebrities there. I know Phelps was behind Tiger on Sunday when he hit on the 16th.
You wouldn't miss him.
Yeah, do you know, but like,
he's got an advantage when it comes to sleep.
Yeah, but the lads in the green jackets, you nearly look at them like celebrities. Everyone goes, there's a member. Yeah, he's a member. What? And no one, you might not have a clue who he is, but you're like, he's a member.
And I didn't mean generally about just Augusta. Like, because you're back to the Enoch, it's happening really fast for you. Is there some point where you're like, okay, this is all normal now, as opposed to, because it's not normal. Like,
yeah, no, it's not. No, I don't really think it doesn't ever be. I always feel a little bit, I always laugh. The first time I ever fly, like, and I don't always like fly business class, but sometimes if I'm on a trip and someone else is paying for it,
yeah, happy days, you gotta do it. Yeah,
but I'll never forget the first time I went business class, and I was sitting there and there was a guy sitting beside, and I remember kind of looking at this kind of older man, and he had his like shirt on, and I was kind of looking at him going like, you know, as if like, you know, I shouldn't be here.
Yeah,
and I was
sitting,
I remember sitting there, and I got a glass of champagne. I was like, oh, I love a glass of champagne. So I drank the glass of champagne. Then I said to the lady, I was like, yeah, I'll have another glass of champagne. She's like, okay. So I drank that fairly quick, and we were a bit delayed taking off, so I sit there, I was like, have another one. So she literally dropped like a mouthful into it, and it was her way of saying stop.
Yeah.
And I was like, so then the other lady across the way, I was like, so I got a full one again, and I drank it, and I got kind of drunk on the plane. I didn't get kind of drunk, I got drunk.
Business class, you have to, like,
exactly. It was my first time, yeah. So I was really like, you know, just, I'm going to like milk this, you know, I might be on again or whatever. So I was drinking away, and then I woke up hungover, and I remember having like a glass of wine with my dinner. I fell asleep after dinner again, and then they come down to give you a bit of a scone at the end. It was Flying Aer Lingus. And I made a bit of a mess. And then about an hour later, I wake up and I'm lying down. Lady wakes me up and she hands me like a wet towel. And I was like, and there was a couple of crumbs on the table. And I went, she once goes, "It's for your face."
Oh, no. Oh. At least you're down to earth. Well.
And I remember when she said it was for your face, for about a split second, I was about to put it on my face. I was like,
with the crumbs on it? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We have another one,
I remember,
sir,
looking over your mind, and then I was kind of going, yeah, I'm definitely not supposed to be here.
We have many towels if you want them.
Yeah.
The next one is Shane Lowry at the Open. This is one of my all time regrets, is that I actually missed this, but I did watch it at home with my family. My mum and dad, we were all on holidays in Wexford watching it, and it was just like the TV was on, the sun was blaring outside, and everybody was happy.
Yeah.
There's just a surge of happiness, particularly because I think the Sunday was so inevitable, because the Saturday was like literally the greatest individual Irish sports performance potentially of all time. It's right up there with Roy Keane in any of those matches that he ever played, the Holland game, the Portugal game, the game in Turin. It's right there with, like, you know, Henry in any match he's done, even with one of your later ones here. It's like he just destroyed the world.
Oh, like, and again, when you said it, you weren't there. I find you're better off, and I was told this at the first Open that I went to. They were like, hey, when it comes to Sunday, the back nine, go back to the NBC tent or whatever and watch it on. And even on the Sunday, I actually watched Shane's round from the media centre.
Right.
Because, like, again, Rory was after missing the cut, so he was gone. Mm. Tiger missed the cut, he was gone. Darren Clarke was gone in a huff. Seen that on the 9th,
no,
on the 18th.
He doesn't huff.
Oh, when he... Did he triple bogey the last or something to miss the cut or something like that? And I remember going, like, this was one of those, he's a member there and stuff, like, so it was like, oh, and he walked off. I felt so bad for him, but like, he could have swung his club at somebody. Like, there was steam coming out of the ears when he walked off. And I, like, everybody tried to clap him, like, to give him the send off,
yeah,
you know, because
yeah,
he's a local and stuff. And yeah, he was just, didn't want to anyway. It was nearly, he stopped get short and just going. But, Shane, yeah, for me, it started with Shane, like, going into the tournament, like, all the talk was about Rory. All the talk was about Rory, you know? And then, obviously, and Tiger had, Tiger was back as well. But on the Saturday, they missed the cut. But on the Friday, on the 10th, was when I had just, like, because I just plopped myself around the course, kind of watching bits and bobs here, there and everywhere. And obviously, Shane had a bit of a crowd following him, so... like, obviously, being in Ireland and everything, I walked up to the tent and he drained, like, I don't know, was it 50 footer or 40 footer? Mm. Huge putt on the tent. And I was with a friend of mine and I remember just kind of punching him in the stomach, like, but I didn't mean to hit him. And I was like, he's 6 under here, yeah, whatever. And it was like,
this is real.
Yeah, we were like, he's actually, mm, you know, possibly in contention here. He could win this. And he walked by me, the track, we were like, the way the tent is, you're kind of standing above the green, like, either side, so you have big crowds, like, it's a bit of like a amphitheater effect nearly or something. But he walked by then, and I remember when he walked by and it was like he had this tunnel vision and he was looking straight forward, and usually everyone's like, oh, Shane, and he's like, whatever, and he just walked by with, I don't know, it was like Tiger-esque or something. I was looking at him going, this fella could, like, do this or whatever.
Resolve, and now he actually had, resolve,
yeah, he had a quiet enough back nine, I remember. And then Saturday happened, and it was, like you say, it was one of the greatest performances, like, we've ever seen. Was he birdied 3-5, I think he birdied the 9th. Again, the 10th then, he had that 7-iron, that low, him and Bo were talking about a 7 and an 8, and he thought he'd pull it left if he hit an 8, and he just bumped it up there. And again, like, you know, when you're playing links golf, it is so much harder than parkland. Like, it's not like you're just going to chip it up and stop it there. Mm. It's more like you need the bounce, you need the rub of the green, like, literally. And I remember when he hit the 7-iron and it just spun up and then it came down off the bank and it landed, I'd know, like, the 8 feet. And it was like, wow, this is incredibly special. And then that back nine, he backed it up and he birdied 15 then. And then on Calamity is the 16th. Which is, and I've played it a few times, like, I think I'd say I get about a 5 or a 6 on it every time. You usually lose a ball, like, because if you're in any way right, it's just off the cliff.
Gone.
And it's gone. And it's a 4-iron for them, like, so it's like 200 plus or whatever. Or maybe, I don't know, on the day, there could have been a wind or whatever, but, like, he hit a 4-iron. And he's, like, the ball bounces, like, at the front of the green and bounces all the way to 8 feet. And he goes up and he drains the putt. And then 17, he nearly chips in. And 18, he's within an inch. He could have been 6 or 7 ahead. And it, like, for me, I'd agree. I'd say it was one of the greatest Irish sporting performances of all time. And I also think, for, like, even for him, the fact that he went and backed it up the next day, given what happened at Oakmont a few years before that, you know, he was in the same position where he had a 4-shot lead and he lost it. And I remember kind of at that time just not understanding. I was a bit like, ah, yeah, but, like, sure, he should be delighted he's even in contention, like, you know. But now it was like, no, this fella's, like, one of the, and again, I think he's elevated himself again, you know, to be one of the best players in the world. I'd even say, like, over the last year, like, there's so much scrutiny about his game now. Like when Shane would play well, people would mention it and go, Shane had a great week. And if he didn't play well, people wouldn't mention it. Now, if he doesn't play well, it's like, what's wrong with Shane? So he's up there with Rory now, where it's like everything's analysed so much. Like, and he's obviously just getting, I think he's getting better and better. But back then, that was, it was one of those moments like where he was now sitting at the top table with, and it does, it obviously makes a huge difference to your career as a golfer. If you can win all the PGA Tour stuff you want, you win a major, you are, you're dining at that top table. And I think not only some lads win a major and it is a flash in the pan, with him it's not, like, he is, you know, one of the best players in the world at the minute. Like,
yeah, and has really leaned in and started to enjoy the leadership role that he's playing, and is, he's totally ready for it now in his life and his career.
I actually think and it's a kind of it's a natural thing. I remember Roy Keane talking about, or some players talking about Keane when he was at Manchester United, when he came at the start and he didn't really say much at all, and it's just he becomes the leader then, and he just becomes one of those top guys, and then he's but I think Shane is like that. I think he loves being in a featured group. He's actually one of these lights, it's like, put the lights on me, the
pressure of it.
I think, like, if he's not in a group where there's no real marquee names in it, I prefer to see him in a group where he's playing with Rory, or he's playing with Scotty, or, you know, even Tiger, whatever. He likes that. I think he likes just walking out there feeling like that the cameras are on him, and he revels in that.
I feel like that 2019 was different, because, like, obviously Harrington was brilliant those couple of majors, 07 08, GMAC at Pebble Beach, Darren Clarke as well, but Lowry was different, because I think it's just a man of the people kind of vibe. You see him at GAA matches, he's so proud to be Irish as well, that we all kind of feel like we're a little bit of Shane Lowry.
Oh, big time. It's the lad next door kind of vibe off him, But it is, and obviously it being in Ireland and all the crowds there, and like how proud, like I remember when he walked to 18 on the Saturday, and it was like the president was just walking up the fairway, and he was just giving, you know, and everybody standing clapping. And
did he get a bus to the Boar's Head that night? Was it the next night?
Oh, that was on the Sunday, where he went straight down to, he went to House in Dublin, actually, and the next day was the Boar's Head. You go to the Boar's Head the next day, of course. and he just celebrated it so well, like, actually. But he really is, like, I did a thing, I was in Florida 2 weeks ago, we were shooting a bit of an ad or something. It was just the easiest day's work ever, like, because it felt like there's no cameras there.
Yeah.
Ask him a question, he's just like, oh, yeah, yeah. And it's just like, he really is like one of the lads. It was like, I have to say now, it was one of the most enjoyable, easiest day's work. I felt like I didn't even work, you know. I just felt like I just turned the camera on there and started talking, and that was it.
You don't do a Shane impression?
I kind of do. It's a bit like that. It's not the best, I find, when I'm doing people in the Midlands. It's not as good, you know. He thinks I can't do him at all, but it's okay. Like, it's not one of my best ones. And then when you're doing someone that you kind of know, you want to have it really good. He's a deep voice. Like, he's got quite a deep voice. You know, but he does that. He kind of his teeth kind of don't really move. It's kind of a bit like that, you know, and sort of. So it's kind of, I don't think he likes it himself, but well, I don't think he cares.
Yeah, send that to him there.
We've got Katie Taylor next against Amanda Serrano. Where were you for this? You're obviously at it.
Yeah, in the garden. I wasn't supposed to be. Again, I was working in Florida, and I was after doing a video for the Westbury, where I had all the Irish people come over and kind of wrecked the place or something.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I went down real big, and I was like, I can't not go. So I came back to Florida. I was supposed to fly back to Ireland from New York. And so I didn't get in the flight, I just stayed. And I was so glad I stayed. It was, again, I know a lot of these are kind of those Irish moments where you're like looking around, you're like, this is special. Yeah. I get quite emotional at stuff. Like, I got emotional at the Grand Prix after it. I was like, how have we got here? I was saying, my wife was with me, like, and I was like, how did this happen? Like, doing a few videos, you know, and you're here or whatever. But I remember the Katie fight, we went into Madison Square Garden. We were in the Westbury drinking. The place, like, it's jammed, wall-to-wall Irish people, everybody's singing songs. Most people aren't even going to the fight. The place, for about 12 blocks around Madison Square Garden, every bar is just packed with Irish people. We get down to Madison Square Garden.
Sorry, everybody should know the Westbury's the pub in New York.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
So the hotel in Dublin.
Shameless plug. but the Westbury, NYC. So we get down there and everyone's just singing. It's the ole, ole, ole crack. And we get into the Madison Square Garden, and for a place that has a reputation of being like really big, when you're in it then you're like, oh, it's not that big, but it's just, there's just thousands of people like going real high up,
yeah,
and the the green flags, the green, white and orange. Then this promo comes out. I was standing there and my brother was with me, my dad was with me. And again, I was getting kind of overcome with emotion, going like, you're kind of in that real sappy stage. You're like, aren't we brilliant? Aren't we just amazing?
Lovely
like,
wee country.
Aren't we like, no other country has this. No, we this is just us. This is like
Puerto
Jesus,
Ricans,
Ireland.
Like.
Yeah, yeah. No, there was, in fairness, about 7 Puerto Ricans there as well. But it was just flooded with Irish people. And yeah, I remember kind of going, am I about to like cry here? And then Katie came out. And whatever music she came out to, it was this kind of, it just, I was expecting like, a bit like the McGregor thing, the Foggy Dew or something, you know, you're expecting like some, so the music then kind of just flattened me. I was like, what's this song? What is this? Now, it obviously works for Katie, you know what I mean? But we were expecting something rebellious or of patriotic, something like whatever. So that kind of, the emotion left me for a minute then. I was kind of going, what's this? What's this song? So she comes in, National Anthem or whatever is played then, and the whole place is just pounding it out like, and it's so loud. The fight starts. First couple of rounds is like they're just feeling each other out. And again, you can't watch a boxing fight if you're invested in the boxing fight.
Oh no.
Not at all. So the fifth round happens and it looks like Serrano's taking her head off, and like how she takes the punishment. You're standing there and her legs are dead straight. She's not even, you know the way you crouch down for grip. It's like she's standing dead straight taking these punches. And like you think it's going to be over. Now, in fairness, it was a 2-minute round. I think that definitely was a benefit. If it was a 3-minute round, I don't know what would have happened. Although I say that, but like your woman was battering the head off her, to use the expression, for about 90 seconds.
Yeah.
So do I think she could have lasted another minute? Probably. It looked like
that was as good as it was going to get. Or yeah. As bad as it was going to get.
Yeah. Like she couldn't put her away, which just you know, as much as people eulogize about Katie Taylor, like when you see that, like because in adversity. Is when you see the real character or the strength of someone. And that fifth round, like, she really took a hammer. And then, obviously, Serrano would have expended a good bit of energy in that fifth round. Came into the sixth. Serrano, she wasn't really on the front foot as much. And then Katie, 7, 8, 9, she won those rounds. And then the tenth round was, like, Hagler-Hearns. Like, the last 30 seconds, they just...
Yeah, at it.
Absolutely went to take each other's heads off. And you're kind of thinking... Both of them like felt they were winning. Why would you risk it? Why would you risk getting knocked out in the last second? Because it really could have happened. And the two of them just had the gloves down and were swinging 1-2s. There was no combinations. There was no jabs. It was literally just 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, back and forth. And the fight ended. If I'm being honest, when I was there, I said, because in my head, she's the local as well. She's like Brooklyn born. And I thought she won the fight. And I was like, oh, she's won the fight. And it was the next day we went to the Westbury and Johnny Longhall says, I thought she won it. And he goes, watch the fight. It's coming on in a half an hour. Watch it without the sound. We all watched it without the sound and you could see she won the fight. You could see she was more accurate, even in the first couple of rounds. Serrano was a bigger puncher. Wasn't a bigger woman in the fight, but she was definitely the bigger puncher and she was more aggressive. She was on the front foot mostly. But Katie was unbelievable in terms of like, you know, styles make fights or whatever, you know, is the cliche, but also like adapting your style and having to go on the back foot. She was incredible.
It is typical boxing bullshit that we're not going to see it again. Like that's the all the problems with the sport writ large. This incredible once in a lifetime thing is only once in a lifetime, folks. There's even though there's a rematch clause, we're not going to get the rematch, I don't think.
Yeah, and I also like again, which goes to Katie's character. The fact that when I seen that fight, I was like, that was a risky fight. And the next fight's risky too. And I'm kind of going, the Irish fight, just fight me.
Yeah.
Just fight me. I'll fight you. Yeah. You know, the winner box the head of me and get the win, take the W.
I think.
But she doesn't.
She deserved
like,
that.
No. Yeah. And no one would judge her. But she is.
We would support her. It'd be like a Kickstarter.
Exactly.
You know? A GoFundMe.
The noise and cacophony of sound in MSG, like when you compare it to something like the Tiger Roar, you know, say just after the national anthem or just after Katie is announced as the winner. What is that like in comparison to something like the Tiger Roar? Because I think, was it London 2012 that the Olympic bout broke decibel levels? Like, it was the loudest moment at the Olympics. So, like, Katie fights generally will be loud.
Oh, yeah. No, to be fair, a golf roar and a boxing roar, I don't think there's no slightly way. I could not come in here with a straight face and say, the Tiger Roar is actually louder than the, you know, when someone's getting their head taken clean off. But Oh yeah, the decibel level on, like when you're in the garden is it's insane. Like it is, you feel like the ground's kind of moving and stuff like that. Now that's your own kind of energy as well. You're like, I remember actually one time I felt the ground moving, where I thought the stadium moved, was when Cluxton kicked the ball over the bar in 2011. I was sitting right behind him, so I had a literally perfect view. He was in the middle between me and the goals.
God, he just nearly getting it.
Yeah, and the ball went over the bar, and I remember it like kind of, I felt the place went like that. And then they won. And
it was an earthquake, was it?
I swear to God. I'd like to see the Richter scale that day in Crow Park, because I felt, I was walking out there going, I'm telling you, the concrete moved. I really thought it moved.
I think sometimes in the stadium it feels like that. When Lara scores his hat-trick, that Tipperary, Kilkenny going for the five in a row, that was also, because that's like two absolutely feverish hurling nations coming together on the day.
Yeah.
And history we made, or not. The song was Awake My Soul, Hillsong Worship. She said afterwards that she wanted to walk out worshipping, but then the noise was so big that she just got lost in the atmosphere. And in that moment, even she forgot God. I made that last bit up, sorry.
But she, I wouldn't mind, when she was walking out, like the camera's on her, and she was just like that, like it was, she had this stare on her. And she actually walked really slow as well. Usually someone comes in with a bit of, especially if you're nervous, you come in with a bit of pace, like,
yeah, you want to get through that.
She walked in and then she stopped and was just looking around, and you could actually see she was so present. She was like, this isn't like, because I presume before that, now I haven't seen all the fights, but she definitely has never fought in a, with a crowd like that, in a place like that, headlining.
No,
for me that was where women's boxing became boxing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the UFC, you don't say women's UFC. Like that was like boxing. And I think obviously what she's done for the sport, you know, it's,
yeah, it's and whatever you want. And we say quite a bit about Eddie Hearn on this show, but like that was his point. And he has been centrally involved in taking her from being an Olympic gold medalist to a headliner in the sport. And, you know, whatever about the fight that he's having at Croke Park at the moment, he does deserve some credit for that. Jamie Domican says, hey Shane, why don't you do your GMAC impression for Connor?
Absolutely not.
He hasn't looked nervous at any point on the show this week, by the way. But now all of a sudden,
I haven't been put under pressure at all.
It's way, way better than mine.
You definitely have.
I've never seen it.
Jesus,
it's
no.
It's way better.
There's so many to choose from. We've
GMAC on GMAC.
It's oh Jesus. What do we talk about?
Yeah, well, we'll talk about Florida. Alligators.
Alligator spiders.
Yikes. Spiders. Yikes, I'll tell you. Senior. Top class.
Biggest fear. Probably my biggest weakness. Cold beer.
Cold beer. Are you a tattoo kind of guy?
Tattoos. No tattoos. Not in the near future either. I don't know. Sorry. The fact that I'm doing an impression beside Conor Murray here is ridiculous, by the way.
We'll have Padraig with GMAC, will we? Who do you want?
The two lads. Well, I can only do one.
He's going to win the Masters.
Well, I don't know. There's so many to choose from, Conor. There's cider.
Why'd you go to live?
I don't know. There's a...
Explain yourself like you did before.
The green, you know, the little bit of cash, you know, dinner and drinks, dinner and a movie. Definitely dinner somewhere.
I think that video's off the internet.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah, it's gone.
Oh, right.
So we'll bring it back. Yeah,
think, well, if you have a strong legal team, you definitely get that.
should rip that. Somebody sure
I think I'm sweating that, now. Yeah. First time this week on the show, I've been sweating.
That's it. That video was reprehensible, for sure. Yeah.
Shawshank Redemption, Gladiator.
So at one stage I was like, oh, you're not going to be able to do all those impressions anymore. But actually, everybody wants to see them because they're even more famous and more important.
The
Live Golfers, yeah.
Sure, I had this conversation with the boys, I remember last year with the Golf Channel. I'm like, you know, like, most of my stable has gone over there. Which suggests that most of the kind of bowsies are gone over there. You know, the guys that you kind of...
Poulter and the lads, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you've seen the Full Swing.
I actually haven't seen it.
The first and last episode only. Brooks, or the Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth, and then the Rory one as well.
Did you watch the worst?
The first one's bad.
In the middle, it's pretty good. Like that first episode was like just... Yeah. I don't know who decided to have the lads FaceTime each other and make it look real. Oh. And, hey, yeah, I'm just doing your wedding speech, man. And he's like, hey, don't mess it up.
Hey.
This is what you put in this show. Like it was, but I will say one thing. I enjoyed it as a show. I think it's like unfair to compare it to F1, given like how open F1 is and how, like, even if you go to an F1 thing and you've got paddock tickets, Lewis Hamilton just is standing right there beside you. Yeah. You're talking to somebody, Max walks by you. Golf just isn't like that. Golf also isn't played at 300 miles an hour. and you could die, you know, if you mess up a shot.
The jeopardy is less.
Yeah, and I thought Poulter's episode in it was very good, like, and he was asked, you know, why did you go to Liverpool? He's like, I made a business decision. And I thought, like, and even DJ said the same thing, and I think anybody that kind of said that, nobody really has judged them.
I'm crying the game, the format's all wrong. Yeah. These guys, it's like, yeah, there's definitely a difference. Honesty helps.
Big work, time, yeah.
You've got to go. I mean, we've gone way over time here, but David Clifford in the 2022 All-Ireland Final. This is kind of up there with Shane Lowry a little bit.
I thought Shane Walsh on the same day.
Shane Walsh was.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I got to see the winning team.
Yeah, for me, my dad is a staunch Galway man, and he was like, oh, Walsh was man of the match. And don't get me wrong, he was amazing. But for me, it's like, who got the result?
Yeah.
Who kicked the last 10 minutes, who got the points or whatever. And Clifford kicked that one from the corner. But like everything he did that day, when you think about his performance and the, a bit like we got an All-Ireland final akin to the World Cup final where you had Mbappe and Messi start. You don't really get that.
Yeah.
You know, how many El Clasicos did Messi or Ronaldo not really show up in? The odd time the two of them might play well. So you got like an All-Ireland final where the two talisman actually showed up and had a shootout nearly between each other. And like Shane Walsh was absolutely like, he was imperious, like in a sense. But like Clifford, and typical of Jack O'Connor, there's always a little, he always throws in a little simple tactic in every final or something. He kicks in a couple of diagonal balls, puts a bit of pressure on the Galway full back line, the goalkeeper. Clifford, 7 minutes in or something, he goes up and he catches a ball like this and just again shows off like every trick in the book he has. You want to kick the ball in low to him, he'll win it in low. Left or right foot, marks, freeze. It was a game where he just showed off every kind of like facet to his game. And on top of that, then he kicked over pressure points, you know, and especially that one in the corner that it was 66 minutes or whatever. Like, I don't really think it was a foul. Yeah, man, he definitely played for it. I think it was Spillane or something, I kind of thought. But he kicks it over from the corner, and everything he just did that day was unbelievable. And for me, like, a lot of people argue, oh, is he the greatest or whatever? And I'm like, not that I'm any sort of beacon of what's great or whatever, but for me he was in the pantheon of greats in my mind about 3 years ago, because I seen him play with a football in his hand.
Yeah,
I seen him play the game. Yeah. And I'm like, the guy bounces the ball different to everybody else. He solos the ball, like he kicked over, I think Gavin White plays him a ball, I think it's his second or third point in the game, and he strokes the ball over the bar and it looks like he taps it over from the 21. He taps it over from about 43 yards out.
Yeah.
Taps it over.
Under tight marking. I think that this was really important because we'd had video footage of him playing in the schools games in Croke Park where he's like a man amongst boys from the time he was under 14. And then there was the great minor team that he was part of. So this is the coronation. And he has to put in a performance worthy of everything up to this point. And everybody always disappoints you in sport. There's always a little bit of a letdown. Mm. And he didn't. There was no letdown. There was like, oh, I'm actually going to be even better. I'm going to carry the team. They needed the marks in the first half. Like, they needed that because Galway come out and they started really well, and everything that they thought about in the build up to the game was like, don't let Galway get off to a good start. Whatever, keep Shane Walsh. And it's like, they couldn't do it. And he's like, no bother. I've been here before. I've seen the movie. I know how it ends. I've been an all-star every year. I've been playing senior lads. I'm going to be man of the match.
Yeah.
Like, it's...
What was it my uncle used to say over in America? He's been living in America, like, far too long, but like he used to say to us before the game, or if it was half time and it was tight or whatever, winners want the ball when the game's on the line. I think it's from, I don't know what film it's from, but that's what Clifford was like. It was like, give me the ball, like I'll win the game, like just put the pressure on me, don't worry about it, I have this. And that's the footballer he is, that's the person he is. I just think he's got it all. He's like, again, like people talk even about Jack and Tiger and who's the greatest. Like, I will say, in 200 years' time, people will only look at numbers. They probably won't delve into, like, whatever. And if Jack is on 18 and Tiger's on 15, people would say Jack is the greatest. But, like, if you've watched golf around then, you'll see in those 10 years, nobody ever played golf like Tiger Woods played golf.
Yeah.
And I think if you just watch David Clifford, for me, and I wasn't around, I wasn't alive when I was, Matt Connor was playing. But, like, when I first seen him on YouTube, I kind of watched and I was like, well, he looks like... he's like Morris Fitz from the noughties or the late 90s. Like, when, and obviously people argue about teams and everything. It's a simple fact that, like, you get better the more you train. So teams are obviously better now and they're more skilled than they were back in the day.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they were better teams, but they're more skillful. But Matt Connor looks like he's teleported from the noughties or something back to the 80s.
Yeah,
and he just drops the shoulder that way. six lads go this way. He just taps the ball over. And I remember watching it going, geez, he actually looks like, because sometimes you watch players from back then, they throw the ball in front of them and they kick it up the field. Some of the greats.
Yeah.
And you're like, but it's not like, and obviously like the lads wouldn't have trained like they do now, but like Matt Connor, for me, looked like that. And again, Morris Fitz. And I think Clifford is like Matt Connor, Morris Fitz, Messi, Mozart, the whole lot of them rolled into one.
I agree.
That's, and I think he's the, for me, he's the best I've ever seen.
Well, you've set a new standard for You Had to Be There. Connor, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Cheers. It's so unexpected.
It's one of those You Had to Be There moments.
You had to be there.
It subsequently genuinely did change everything about my life.
You had to be there.
OTB AM with Gillette Labs. Get the ultimate shave or your money back. Neon Night Edition available now.